AI Dream would survive it.
The idea of artificial intelligence is magical.
The Artificial Human on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Starting next Wednesday at 3:30.
This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Friday, the 23rd of January. Good morning. This is Today with Anna Foster in Salford and Justin Webb in London.
Good morning. The headlines today, negotiators from Ukraine, Russia and the US are heading to Abu Dhabi for talks on ending the war in Ukraine after late night discussions at the Kremlin were described as constructive and very frank. We'll be hearing from Robert Wilkie, who served in President Trump's first cabinet.
I have absolutely no confidence that Putin will concede on any major points in these negotiations, and he'll just be playing for time until the spring comes.
And the Australian commissioner who introduced the social media ban for under-16s has told the BBC she's now working closely with UK regulators.
And also in today's programme, a BBC investigation suggests there are more than 10 huge fly-tipping sites across England containing 20,000 tonnes of waste and linked to organised crime.
At certain times, there have been half a dozen lorries or more tipping every day, bulldozers here levelling the site. So it's been quite significant in terms of the ongoing activity every day of the working week.
Plus, do we need fewer police forces in England and Wales? The government is planning to cut many of them. Why? What will the gain be? And ahead of tonight's Traitors Final, we look at how the show has managed to perfect the art of creating TV villains. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
Diplomatic efforts to end the war in Ukraine are gathering pace, with negotiators from Kyiv set to join Russian and US officials in what President Zelensky says will be their first trilateral talks. The discussions in the United Arab Emirates over the next 2 days follow a high-level meeting in Moscow last night between President Putin and a US delegation, including President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff. Mr. Trump said everyone was making concessions to get a deal done. From Moscow, here's our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg.
According to the Kremlin, the discussions in Moscow were substantive, constructive and very frank. But there was no agreement on the key sticking point, territory. After the meeting, President Putin's foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, said the US envoys had been told that without resolution of the territorial issue, there could be no long-term peace in Ukraine. He gave no details, but Moscow has been demanding that Ukraine cede those parts of the Donbass region still under Kyiv's control, Ukrainian land that Russia has failed to seize in nearly 4 years of war. Mr. Ushakov said President Putin had made it clear that until a diplomatic solution could be achieved, Russia would continue to pursue the objectives of its special military operation. This, he said, was especially true on the battlefield.
The European Union has said it will defend itself against any form of coercion after President Trump withdrew his threat to levy tariffs on US allies who oppose his plan to take over Greenland. Speaking after an emergency meeting of EU leaders in Brussels last night, the European Council President Antonio Costa said the bloc would continue to stand up for its interests. The President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, told a news conference the EU had responded well to President Trump's threat.
We followed 4 key principles: firmness, outreach, preparedness and unity. And it was effective, so going forward we should maintain this very approach.
President Trump is at the centre of fresh criticism after he claimed NATO troops had stayed a little back off the front lines during the war in Afghanistan. Speaking to Fox News, he renewed his criticism of the alliance, saying he wasn't sure it would be there if the US needed it. The Labour chair of the Commons Foreign Affairs Committee, Dame Emily Thornberry, said his comments were an absolute insult to the 457 British service personnel killed in the conflict. The BBC has discovered there are more than 500 illegal dumps operating across England, with at least 11 huge sites containing more than 20,000 tonnes of waste. Police say many are linked to organised crime gangs. Campaigners say not enough has been done to stop illegal dumping or to clear the sites. The Environment Agency's Enforcement and Investigations Manager, Emma Viner, says it's a big problem.
We share the public's disgust for the things that are happening and for the waste crime that we're seeing. And we are taking action. Every year we're shutting down hundreds of illegal waste sites, preventing waste from being illegally exported. But it's a dynamic picture for all the waste sites that we're closing. We're seeing more and more pop up around the country.
The Australian Internet Safety Regulator, who introduced the country's social media ban for under-16s, has said she's working with the UK on its own potential implementation of online restrictions for children. Sir Keir Starmer has announced a consultation on implementing such a ban and is facing pressure from some MPs to act immediately. Speaking to the BBC, Julie Inman-Grant said the ban was going pretty well in Australia, but she admitted it would take time to change the behaviour of social media companies.
With these systems that are literally built to keep them entrenched and entranced, it's just not a fair fight. To make their platform safer and to keep kids away until they're ready is, I think, that monumental circuit breaker move. And if other countries do that, then we have a network effect.
MPs on the Public Accounts Committee say thousands of people are living in homes that pose a risk to their health and safety after what they describe as the catastrophic failure of two government insulation schemes. Major defects have been found in more than 30,000 houses fitted with insulation since 2022. Zoe Conway reports.
Over the last 15 years, billions of pounds of public money have been spent on insulation to make homes warmer and help cut energy bills. But in too many cases, the work has been of such low quality, it has led to damp and mould. The committee said the level of non-compliance by installers was so high, the Serious Fraud Office should be called in. The government said it had inherited a broken system from the Conservatives and said that of all the non-compliant homes found so far, more than 50% had been remediated at no cost to the consumer.
New figures show the number of shadow fleet vessels and crews being abandoned at sea hit a record level last year. More than 6,000 seafarers were cut off by their employers, leaving many without payment or basic provisions. David Woodell reports.
The International Transport Workers Federation reports hearing more from seafarers who suspect they're on ships carrying sanctioned goods. Recently, the US has seized oil tankers with links to Russia and Venezuela, as it's becoming harder for these ships to operate. Some owners are abandoning them. The BBC's heard from a senior officer on one such tanker, one of more than 400 abandoned ships last year. Without sanctions, his cargo of Russian oil would be worth around $47 million. In effect, it's untradeable. He and his crew have been stranded at anchor in East Asia for 2 months, unpaid and with no means to get home.
More details have been released of the National Memorial to Queen Elizabeth II, which will be built in St James's Park in London. It's been disclosed the main statue will show the late Queen standing rather than on horseback, as previously illustrated.
Thank you, Jane. It's 7 minutes past six. Let's see what the weather has in store for us today with Simon King. Morning, Simon.
Good morning, Anna. Yes, unsettled again, the weather for many of us. We've got some rain that's moving its way in across southern areas with some strong winds. So this is all linked into Storm Ingrid, which was actually named by the Portuguese Weather Service for the impacts expected there. But as I said, it will bring us some strong winds. So for southwest England, southeast England, Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, that rain is currently moving its way northward. It will gradually just ease off as it pushes further northward into Wales and the Midlands and eastern England during this afternoon. There may be some limited bright spells for a time, but further heavy showers will come in across the south and the southwest in particular. We're going to see some strong winds with coastal gales and some large waves as well. So coastal overtopping is likely. Temperatures getting to 6 to 10 Celsius. Now for northwest and northeast England, pretty cloudy with some rain this morning in the far north. That's going to clear and there'll be lots of cloud around. Still some showers likely around the Pennines, quite breezy. Temperatures of 6 to 8 degrees. For Northern Ireland, some rain this morning, clearing to the northeast, a few bright spells, but cloudy again with some rain this afternoon, highs of 7 or 8 degrees. And for Scotland, heavy rain continues in the northeast of Scotland, and with colder air digging in, that is turning to snow over the higher ground of the Grampians. Some rain as well across southern Scotland, but drier and brighter in northwestern areas, and highs of 3 to 6 Celsius.
Thank you for that, Simon. 9 minutes past six, let's have our first look at the papers. The Financial Times saying allies of Sir Keir Starmer on Labour's National Executive Committee are plotting to stop Andy Burnham from standing in the Gorton and Denton by-election over fears that a return to Westminster for the Greater Manchester Mayor could see him launch a leadership challenge to the Prime Minister. Does Andy Burnham have the bottle, asks the headline in the Daily Mail, which claims Labour is descending into civil war now that what it calls a plum seat is up for grabs.
A supporter of Sir Keir Starmer tells the iPaper this morning, we don't need an Andy Burnham circus, which will only divert resources, manpower and money away from vital council elections. The Times suggests that Downing Street could impose a loyalty pledge on potential Labour candidates for the by-election, insisting that they confirm their allegiance to the Prime Minister, thereby painting Mr Burnham as a traitor if he does launch a leadership bid.
The Daily Telegraph claims Sir Keir's national security adviser has been lobbying for Hamas to keep some of its guns as part of the Gaza peace process. Jonathan Powell is reported to believe that the move would help break the deadlock in stalled talks on phase two of the ceasefire and has cited Britain's experience with Republican terrorism as evidence that the plan could work. The paper says it has approached him for comment.
A suggestion that the government could water down its plans to reform the system for special educational needs is featured on the front page of the Times this morning. It says Downing Street's thought to be nervous that a backbench rebellion could lead to another government U-turn, meaning officials are now leaning towards tinkering around the edges of the existing system to avoid upset. A source has told the paper that the briefings have been uninformed.
And with the headline shameful, the Daily Mirror says Donald Trump has sparked fury by saying UK military personnel did not serve on the front line in Afghanistan. The mother of the youngest British soldier to die in the conflict tells the paper that the US president is out of touch with reality.
It's 11 minutes past six now.
And let us turn to what Donald Trump has been saying, because he's further upset his NATO allies with those remarks about the Afghan contributions that they made. He's also been talking about Greenland on his flight back to the US from his Davos trip. Our correspondent Peter Bowes has been telling me more.
Donald Trump is now back at the White House after really a frenetic couple of days in Davos, with many questions remaining about the future relationship between the US and Greenland. And he was questioned about this by reporters during the flight back to Washington, and he reiterated that the framework deal was forever, infinity, as he put it, and that he said the US could do anything it wanted. He talked about having full access before he left Davos. He said, we can do military. He said, it's being negotiated. Asked whether that gave the US ownership of land, he didn't give a clear answer. He said we're going to work together and that NATO would be involved. He said the only expense to the US would be the cost of building the Golden Dome, the defence system, and that he said we would know more from him in 2 weeks' time. So clearly there is relief that this looming crisis between the US and its European allies has been averted. There will be no tariffs related to Greenland. But I think it's fair to say that the future of the, more broadly, the transatlantic relationship is very much up in the air after this trip.
And that relationship not improved by what he said in a separate interview with Fox News about the contribution of other countries to the effort in Afghanistan.
Yes, he was giving an interview to Fox Business. He questioned the role of NATO troops during the war in Afghanistan, as you say. Talking more generally about NATO, he said he wasn't sure that the military alliance would be there for America if we ever needed them. We've never needed them, he said, adding, we have never really asked anything of them. And he went on, he said, they'll say they sent some troops to Afghanistan, and they did. They stayed a little back, a little off the front lines. And it's that comment that has prompted a furious international reaction. The Dutch Foreign Minister, David van Wiel, said Mr. Trump's remarks were false and that Europeans shed blood in support of US troops in Afghanistan. There's been outrage amongst British MPs. The president had expressed similar sentiments earlier during the World Economic Forum, and he was picked up about them by Mark Rutter, the NATO Secretary General, especially the comment that Mr. Trump wasn't sure Europeans would come to the rescue of the US if needed, if attacked. And Mr. Rutter, addressing quite a stony-faced Donald Trump, said, let me tell you, they will, and they did in Afghanistan. He said it pained him if Mr. Trump thought otherwise. But the president went ahead and, in effect, repeated the same comments, the same sentiments during his Fox interview.
Peter Bowes, thank you.
It's 14 minutes past six. Hundreds of illegal waste dumps are operating across England. Some of them are so huge that they contain tens of thousands of tonnes of rubbish. A BBC investigation has uncovered the scale of the problem. Jenny Kumar is our correspondent. Jenny, this is a real issue.
Yeah, and we found that, you know, some of these sites are massive. So the largest site was 280,000 tonnes. That's in Cheshire. There's two sites that are around 50,000 tonnes in Lancashire and Cornwall. So 11 what we call supersized sites over 20,000 tonnes. Four have been closed down as far as we're aware, and there could be basically several more because the Environment Agency was only able to give us data about the ones they actually know about. And over the last week, we visited three sites, including one near Gloucester that's spread over 2 acres. It's got huge mounds of building waste, so rubble, bricks, sand and tiles. And it's clear to see that it's been through some sort of shredding process. It was in lots of small bits to make it easier to transport and dump. And as you can imagine, there's lots of anger, frustration and disappointment among people living near these sites. They've lost faith and the authorities tasked with dealing with this. And that's the Environment Agency, who's responsible for tackling and prosecuting the large industrial size dumps, and the police, who have a role in hunting down the organised crime gangs. And these are operating without the required permits, avoiding paying costly landfill taxes, and basically profiting from the harm they're causing. It's what's seen as a low-risk, high-reward crime. Now, last October, a House of Lords committee described this crime as the new narcotics, saying it costs the economy £1 billion a year, and their inquiry found a lack of joined-up working between the different public bodies, that the authorities were under-resourced and they were failing to enforce effective deterrence. And these concerns were very much echoed by the campaigners and the people living near the sites that we've spoken to.
Jenny Kumar, our rural affairs correspondent, thank you. We'll hear more from that investigation after seven as well.
Time now, 16 minutes past six. If you're trying to do business with the USA, how are you feeling about life this morning? After another volatile week for global trade, here is Leanna now with the Business News. Morning, Leanna.
Morning, Justin. That's right. At the start of this week, US President Donald Trump said the United States would impose new tariffs of 10%, potentially rising to 25% on imports from 8 allies, including the UK, who he said were obstructing his claims on Greenland. Those measures were supposed to come in on February 1st, which is only just over a week away. But by Wednesday evening, after what the president described as a productive meeting with NATO, those tariffs were suddenly dropped, at least for now, with further talks promised ahead. So what does this mean for British companies that rely on exporting to the United States? William Butler Adams is the managing director of Brompton, Britain's biggest bike maker, and he joins me now. Good morning, William.
Leanna, good morning.
So just outline for us how much of your business is exports to the US, and when trade policy can change this quickly, how do you plan for that?
So we sell about 10% of our bikes out to the US, and it's our fifth biggest market. Super important, super strategic. In fact, we spent the last 4 years developing a product for the US, our new G-Line Electric, specifically for that market. So it's a really important market. It's the biggest global consumer in the world. So we want to trade there, and we have some great customers and great partners in the US.
But you pulled out of New York and Washington stores, didn't you? You had physical stores there.
We did. And that was a really tough decision, particularly New York. We'd had New York for 10 years. It's been a great store for us. The lease came up for renewal, and we decided we weren't going to continue to renew the lease. Washington, we decided that we were actually going to break the lease early. And in those cases, the problem with a lease is, and a store is when you renew it, you're renewing it for another 5 years. And we're in a situation in the US, as we've just heard, where, and we made this decision 4 months ago when we got the original 10% tariff. But even now, since then, we suddenly find ourselves coming very close to finding another 10, potentially 25% on top. Well, if we're selling bikes into a store, we've signed a 5-year lease, the landlord isn't going to care about our situation with tariffs. And if suddenly our product is 25% more expensive or close to that, that can massively affect our sales. So we had to change our strategy. Owning leases is too risky in a volatile environment that we find ourselves in the US, notwithstanding the fact that there's loads of potential. So working with independent bike shops who hold, in the case of REI, they hold bikes, they hold skiing equipment, they've got a much more diverse portfolio in their shops, we can work with them and direct to consumer.
Now, President Trump's goal with tariffs is to get companies to manufacture in the US. Would you ever do that?
Again, I mean, the idea is great and we need to grow. You know, there is potential for us to assemble bikes in the US, and we know that the US consumer loves made in America. So that concept is great. But you sort of got to get to a point where you have enough critical mass in a territory to justify then setting up a potentially localized production. And our plan, and all these great plans, you know, they change. But our plan was, you know, we start with one store, there we go on to two, we start building the market, it gets to a critical mass, get to 10,000 units in territory, and then potentially we're in the position to be able to do that. But where we're at the moment is we haven't got close enough to that. And the volatility is doing the very opposite. It's causing us to close stores. We've had to let go of 16 really good staff. And in fact, we're sort of going backwards rather than going forwards.
And also Brompton, it's British. Would that kind of be not great for the brand?
So you can be a British brand, but you can also be assembled in America. So you've got to weigh up those two. And we certainly have plenty of customers who love that we are British. But also we know that in America, both from a tariff perspective and also from a consumer perspective, made in America matters a lot. So you've got to weigh both of those elements up. But the policy at the moment, that isn't even a choice at the moment. It cannot happen because critical mass isn't there.
All right.
So, I mean, the irony of all of this is we're in one hand having to make some quite difficult decisions because there's so much uncertainty. Mm. It may just be that having launched a fantastic new bike into the market, and yes, we have got tariffs, but most of the rest of the bike market is in a worse position than us with bigger tariffs. So ironically, we may suddenly find that, you know, we are suddenly more competitive and we see our sales really take off. But when you have this uncertainty, it's very hard to plan. So you have to be extremely agile and be ready to move quite quickly, depending on how the landscape changes.
All right. William Butler Adams, Managing Director of Brompton, thank you so much for joining us. Now, let's get the latest on a few big company stories we've been following. First up, TikTok. It sealed a deal with the White House to split its US operations from its global business, which means it can continue operating there. Victoria Scholar, Head of Investment with Interactive Investor in London. Victoria, what are the details of this deal?
Yeah, so it will continue to run as a new American entity under a joint venture in the US with investors like Oracle and Silver Lake. This will end a long-standing dispute over the very popular app that spans more than 5 years. The US is an extremely important market for TikTok, about 150 million users there. So that's almost half of the entire population. But some are saying that this is a win for China because a full divestment has been avoided. ByteDance will keep hold of its intellectual property and algorithm. It will still hold almost 20% of the company, so it's not a full breakaway. And it means that the company can continue to generate significant revenue and earnings.
We've also had reports this morning that Elon Musk's rocket company, SpaceX, had started looking for bankers for a listing that could come as soon as this year. I mean, potentially that's a huge new company to enter public markets, a $1.5 trillion valuation. Wouldn't that put SpaceX in the same leagues as the world's biggest listed tech firms?
Absolutely. This is the world's most valuable startup, and it could be the biggest IPO potentially sometime later this year. As you said, a report in the FT saying that it's been lining up for banks, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley and Bank of America. And clearly it's looking to raise money and capitalize on the fact that markets are doing very well at the moment. Listed space stocks in particular have been faring very, very well lately, the likes of AST, Space Mobile and Rocket Lab.
Also, we're going to talk about Paramount launching a proxy battle over the purchase of Warner Brothers Discovery. Any reaction in the markets to that?
Yeah, so we saw that Netflix shares were actually down 2% yesterday after Paramount extended the deadline by a month on its hostile offer to the 20th of February. So it gives it a bit more time to decide what to do next. But at the moment, Netflix is still winning the race after it announced that fresh all-cash bid this week in a deal still valued at $82.7 billion. So it will get assets like Harry Potter, Game of Thrones and Batman if it does win the deal. Paramount is clearly going to be deliberating whether or not to up its offer at the moment.
Yes, okay. Victoria Scholar, thank you so much. Yeah, it's telling shareholders that they should vote against Netflix's all-cash offer for the company presented earlier this week. Paramount has said that not only does its $108 billion offer value Warner Brothers shares more highly, but that it's also more likely to attain regulatory approval in the US and in Europe. So to tell us more about the potential significance of European oversight in this saga is Tommaso Valletti, Professor of Economics at Imperial College London and former chief competition economist at the European Commission. European regulators, they're reported to be looking at both bids simultaneously. Tommaso, from your experience, how unusual is that?
Good morning. It's very unusual, and I'm not aware of any precedent, in fact, where Brussels has simultaneously reviewed two competing bids for the same company at the same time. What's interesting here is that a parallel review in Brussels could shape, influence the contest by quickly creating one bidder while subjecting the other to a longer investigation. As you said, the board of Netflix recommended to support Warner Brothers recommended to support the Netflix offer and reject the Paramount. However, if Paramount is smart and goes in front of the European Commission in Brussels by saying, look, we're not anti-competitive, this is going to be, you know, setting a front runner, because they can say instead it would take much longer to clear the Netflix offer. So this is interesting.
Yeah. Could this give the European Commission real leverage to shape which one emerges as the front runner?
So there is, first of all, little question that the Commission has to examine their takeover, because companies must notify the European authorities. It's not just they decide when and how to do it. So they have to do it because it's a very large deal in any case. According to my experience, though, and especially now because of the current geopolitics, I don't see, say, a prohibition coming under any scenario. Usually they talk tough, but then they immediately look for remedies and then they clear the transaction. The two offers, though, have different antitrust concerns. They're not identical.
Yeah, on the one hand, it's Netflix's scale and streaming. Then the other, it's Paramount's studio footprint. What raises tougher antitrust questions?
So the Paramount bid is probably more traditional, because this is about reducing the number of large independent content providers. Over the past many years, Hollywood studios have gone through consolidation, and this is yet another instance of that. It will create market power, but you may say this is putting together number two and number four or five of the Hollywood studios, and so it's not that big in simple terms. Instead, Netflix, in the subscription video of demand, they have in excess of 50% market share in all European markets, including the UK. This is really dominance, and strengthening dominance is something that authorities will never allow. So in a sense, it's more complicated than Netflix deal, I would say.
All right. Tommaso Valletti, Professor of Economics at Imperial College London and former Chief Competition Economist at the European Commission. Thank you so much for joining us. And this is a story that we'll be, you know, looking at for a while to come, I believe.
Yeah, I think so. Thank you, Leanna. It is 28 minutes past six. It's time for the sport. Mike Williams is here. Morning.
Hello, Anna. Let's head first, shall we, live to Melbourne, where the final remaining Brit in the singles at the Australian Open tennis is due on court in the next hour or so, Abigail Johnson.
Yeah, that would be Cameron Norrie, seeded and with a tough task in front of him, because at tour level, he has never beaten Alexander Zverev. The world number three holds a 6-0 advantage. They're going to be getting on court a little later on John Cain Arena, the third show court. And Norrie does have the encouragement that he took Zverev to five sets here a couple of years ago. I've currently got eyes on Coco Gauff, who's made the semi-finals here previously. She is pushing for the break of serve and the decision deciding set the number three seed against fellow American Hayley Baptiste.
Abigail, live in Melbourne, many thanks. We'll have regular trips back to the tennis throughout the programme this morning. Next, to football and a mixed night for British clubs in the Europa League.
Final whistle goes and the cheers from the home fans are almost drowned out by the boos from the travelling Forest supporters, because that was a night to forget for Forest on their travels in Europe.
It's so frustrating because the players have been terrific in training, the players who were going to play tonight, the organisation, the way they've performed in training. I mean, God, it's incredibly frustrating. That is incredibly frustrating.
Yes, Sean Dyche's Nottingham Forest were booed off by their travelling fans after Ryan Yates's own goal condemned them to a 1-0 defeat away to Portuguese side Braga in the Europa League. Forest now likely to face a two-legged playoff next month to reach the last 16. Much better news for Aston Villa. They guaranteed a top eight league phase finish with a game to spare after a 1-0 win in Turkey away to Fenerbahce. Meanwhile, it was a case of what might have been for Celtic.
And then shuffles onto the left foot. Let's fly! Oh, what a goal! And Bologna are back on level terms. Flies past Kasper Schmeichel. And it is Bologna 2, 10-man Celtic 2.
Tonight, I think we've given ourselves a chance. That's all, a chance of qualifying. From that viewpoint, I'm delighted.
Manager Martin O'Neill there, focusing on the positives, despite Celtic letting a two-goal lead slip away to Bologna. They drew 2-2 in the end. Their fate will be sealed next Thursday. Rangers' slim hopes of progressing are over, though. Despite picking up a first win of the Europa League this season, they beat Ludogorets by 1-0. Finally, cricket and England are 1-0 down in their three-match one-day series against Sri Lanka. Harry Brooks' side lost the first match yesterday by 19 runs in Colombo.
Sri Lanka played well. They probably outperformed us there. They've especially outfielded us, which is something that we need to go back and look at. And tough conditions for us in the second half, especially batting second. So the toss proved pretty vital in the end.
Second one-day international in the series is in Colombo tomorrow.
Mike, thank you.
Hello, I'm Greg Jenner, and good news, You're Dead to Me is back for a new series.
Here we go.
Yes, we'll explore Emperor Nero's notorious reign with Professor Mary Beard and Patton Oswalt.
I would not want my daughter having the remote control, let alone an empire.
We'll dissect the decadent life of Philippe Duc d'Orléans with Tom Allen.
I've often tried to pretend I'm an aristocrat and been very quickly knocked down.
And there'll be so much more with comedians like Olga Koch, Mike Wozniak and Ria Lina.
I'm excited.
You're Dead to Me, the comedy podcast that takes history seriously. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And at 29 minutes to 7, it's time for a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
Discussions between Russian, Ukrainian and American officials on ending the war in Ukraine will take place in the United Arab Emirates later. Russia confirmed the talks after a late-night meeting in Moscow between the US envoy Steve Witkoff and President Putin. The Kremlin described that meeting as useful, but warned that a durable peace would not be possible unless territorial issues were resolved. The European Union has said it will defend itself against any form of coercion after President Trump withdrew his threat to levy tariffs on US allies who opposed his plan to take over Greenland. After talks in Brussels, it was also announced that the EU would invest more into security in the Arctic. The Australian regulator, who introduced a social media ban for under-16s, has told the BBC she is in regular contact with her counterparts in the UK. Julie Inman-Grant said the effect could be monumental if other countries joined suit. The BBC has discovered there are more than 500 illegal rubbish dumps operating across England, with at least 11 huge sites containing more than 20,000 tonnes of waste. Campaigners say not enough has been done to stop illegal dumping or to clean them up. The Environment Agency said it was committed to tackling waste crime and trying to disrupt those who profited from it. An influential group of MPs has warned that thousands of people are living in damp and mouldy homes that pose health risks after what they describe as the catastrophic failure of two government insulation schemes. The government said it was categorically untrue there were widespread health and safety risks. Some of the biggest names in rock and pop have recorded a new album in aid of the children's charity War Child. Organisers say the proceeds of Help 2 will go towards helping millions of children affected by war in Ukraine, Sudan, Gaza and beyond. Musicians taking part in the project include the Arctic Monkeys, Blur, Olivia Rodrigo, Ezra Collective and Pulp's Jarvis Cocker.
Thank you for that. 27 minutes to 7 is the time. Vladimir Putin has been meeting Steve Witkoff, the US envoy in Moscow, as we were hearing in the news. More than 3 hours of Ukraine-focused talks. Now the venue moving on to the United Arab Emirates. Let's talk to Sarah Rainsford, our BBC correspondent, who's talking to us this morning from Kiev. It's interesting, isn't it, Sarah, that this seems to have been substantive, at least seems to have been substantive, and yet when you look at what they're saying about what has been achieved, it's difficult to see.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, from Ukraine's perspective, I think what they would say is that they've engaged with the peace process that's being led by the United States actively from the start. They've been showing willing. They don't want to be the ones to be seen as an impediment to peace. And now this is crunch time, essentially, for Russia on the first area of the negotiations where Ukraine and the United States say that they have essentially reached an agreement. And that's the issue of security guarantees. It's a phrase that we've heard an awful lot in recent weeks and months, but essentially it means what Ukraine would get from the United States in terms of military support if Russia were to invade again in the future. So I think, you know, these first trilateral talks that will take place today in the United Arab Emirates will be a chance for Russia, the Americans, and Ukraine to sit around the same table for the first time in a very, very long time and to see whether that security guarantees deal is actually something Russia will accept. So I think that is a kind of crunch time because so far we haven't heard from Russia on that kind of thing.
Do the Ukrainians behind the scenes actually think that they're taking part in a kind of sham process? They have to take part in it because of Donald Trump. But actually, as we're going to hear later in the programme from Robert Wilkie, who used to work for Donald Trump, he thinks he's just being strung along by Moscow.
I think that's a fair assessment. I think Ukraine has to engage because it really does need American support. It needs basically those Patriot air defense missiles because it needs to defend its cities against ongoing Russian attacks. And remember, you know, we're right in the middle of a bitter winter now and Russian attacks on the energy infrastructure, so on civilian energy infrastructure, deliberate targeted attacks have been intensifying, leaving people freezing in their own homes. So I think, you know, trying to tell Ukrainians that Russia is serious about wanting peace in any sense is a really tough sell. People just don't believe that here. So they do think this is the moment where, yes, Ukraine has been going along with what Donald Trump has been demanding, which is to engage with Russia, and now it's time for Russia to deliver. But whether or not, in fact, the United States pushes Russia to deliver on anything is a massively open question, given how Donald Trump has talked about Russia in the past and given how the pressure has always been on Ukraine until this point.
Sarah Rainsford in Kiev. Thank you.
Let's get the view from Brussels on both Ukraine and Greenland and the US, of course. Nick Beek is our correspondent there. Nick, morning. On Ukraine, we heard those really interesting, quite strongly worded comments from President Zelensky yesterday, really criticising his European allies, saying that they haven't been doing enough for him.
Morning, Anna. Yes, and for now, they're choosing to ignore it, certainly publicly. I think, first of all, they're only just sort of coming up for air, taking a breath after this row with Donald Trump. I guess privately, among the members, the 27, there could be a range of opinions, possibly a sense that Mr. Zelensky's ungrateful. Others may think he's actually right in part of the things he's saying. Or maybe there's an acknowledgement that potentially this was a strategy to try and mirror some of the language that President Trump uses, this very harsh rhetoric, to keep him on side. And certainly when they're speaking publicly, the message remains the EU stands with Ukraine, although clearly President Zelensky believes that that support should translate to a lot more.
And perhaps it's sunk in. We heard from Antonio Costa, the president of the European Council, last night after that emergency meeting, and he was saying that the EU will stand up for its interests and defend itself.
Yes, and I think, you know, undoubtedly this has been a bruising, bewildering week for the Europeans. You can hardly say it's a wake-up call because they've had 5 years of Donald Trump, including a year of supercharged Trump 2.0. But, you know, I think undoubtedly, Anna, something changed this week. When the president reaches for his favourite lever, tariffs, but then applies it to the threat towards allies when they're standing up for the principle of territorial integrity, you know, something does change. And it jolted Europe into using language it hadn't used before towards the US. You know, I've been listening to some of these officials for 5 years now, and every sentence is carefully calibrated. But there were times where they were talking about the Americans and the Russians in the same breath. It might have been a subtle phrase here or there, but some people went further. Emmanuel Macron was talking about neo-colonial imperialism. imperial ambitions, and it wasn't clear whether he or others were talking about President Trump or President Putin. But I guess the thing to stress is, although the Europeans think that they got President Trump to back down through this combination of harsh language and also dangling the prospect of a really harsh, really strong economic counterstrike, ultimately, they didn't have to put their money where their mouth was on those retaliatory tariffs. And in that respect, it seems like it's kind of business as normal, going back to this trade deal that was agreed with the Americans last year. But I guess also in their mind, Anna, is the fact that it was actually that meeting between Mr. Trump and the NATO boss, Mark Rutte, that seemed to catapult him into this U-turn. EU leaders will be mindful of that and also will be wondering, you know, what was in that deal and will it ultimately satisfy Mr. Trump's ambitions when it comes to the Arctic?
Lots to consider. Nick Beek in Brussels, thank you.
It is 21 minutes to seven. We are to get fewer police forces in England and Wales. A radical rethink, we are told, though it's not going to happen for some time. Damien Grammaticus is our political correspondent. What's been planned, Damien?
Morning, Justin. So, yes, this is what we're going to hear on Monday. So the Home Secretary is going to lay out this idea that basically 43 forces across England and Wales could be reduced to, we don't know the exact number, there will be a public consultation, but maybe a dozen. And those sort of mega forces would have a remit to focus on major crimes. So serious organised crime, murder, drugs. And below that, the idea is to create local policing areas. So they would be very locally focused within every city, town, borough. And they would be tasked with fighting local crime, so shoplifting, phone theft, that sort of thing. And the government says that this is because basically the current system is bureaucratic. There's lots of sort of backroom functions that are being duplicated. And also a sense amongst people that a lot of crime simply isn't being tackled. So that's what they want to address.
But, I mean, the argument for the local forces has always been that it brings them closer to the people, that they understand localities, etc., etc. And it just seems to me that, and obviously within the local forces, there are already presumably more locally focused groups. I'm just not quite sure what they think the gain will be, unless it is mainly financial.
Well, I think what they say is that they want to address the sort of twin things, which is that there's many forces that are small, don't have the resources to tackle major crimes and the expertise. But equally, there is this sort of sense that if you live in a local area and report a crime, you may not ever even see a policeman come and investigate it. But interestingly, I mean, the opposition, Conservatives, saying there is no evidence that merging forces cuts crime or improves performance. And what they say is you take a look at London, and the Met, they say, has the lowest crime-solving rates, and big is not necessarily better. But what the Home Secretary's sort of supporters say is that she understands this. She grew up in a family running a shop. They experience shoplifting. She is determined to shake things up. The sort of caveat there, though, is that none of this would happen before the next parliament. So it could be the mid-2030s before you saw it.
So half the time they're telling us that there's an epidemic of everyday offences, and the rest of the time they're telling us we're not actually going to do this thing that apparently solves it until the end of the next parliament.
Well, that is because they say they want to have a sort of public consultation and a review to look at exactly how many forces there should be and how this should be structured. If you can't see, I mean, Labour did look at this 20 years ago and there was a plan to do it. That was stopped.
All right. Damien Grammaticus, thank you very much.
It's 17 minutes to seven. Opposition parties accused the government of running scared yesterday in Parliament after 29 councils in England were allowed to postpone elections due to take place in May. Here's our correspondent, Sean Curran.
Sometimes when reaching for the perfect phrase, a politician will seek inspiration from the past and channel their inner Churchill, Lloyd George, Thatcher or Mrs. Merton.
What was it about the Labour Party's collapse in the opinion polls that first attracted him to the cancellation of local elections?
That was the Conservative shadow local government secretary, Sir James Cleverly, reacting to the news that some council elections due to take place in May are to be postponed. The delays range from Basildon to Burnley, Hindburn to Hastings and Worthing to West Lancashire. The elections have been shelved because of plans to scrap the two-tier system of county and district councils in England and create larger unitary authorities. The local government secretary, Steve Reid, told MPs that his department had written to 63 councils in December, asking to hear their views, and had received more than 350 representations from local authorities and others.
I have decided to bring forward legislation to postpone 29 elections. I have deposited a list of these in the House of Commons library. I have received one further representation this morning that I will consider, then report back to the House on my decision.
He insisted the vast majority of local elections would go ahead as planned, and he said he wasn't the first minister to delay a poll as part of a reorganisation.
The Shadow Secretary of State suggested on Tuesday that the previous government had not done the same thing. But perhaps he has forgotten the postponements in Weymouth and Portland in 2018, or Aylesbury, Chiltern, South Buckinghamshire and Wickham in 2019, or Cumbria, North Yorkshire and Somerset in 2021.
Order.
The Speaker, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, interrupted Steve Reid to deliver a rap on the knuckles to Reform UK's Robert Jenrick, who'd heckled the minister.
I have a lot of respect for the honourable gentleman, but I don't expect him to walk in and start mouthing off the moment he sits down, please. And I'm sure he would like to catch my eye. And it's not the best way. Secretary.
Well, indeed, it was the self-styled new sheriff in town, the Right Honourable Member, now, of course, a member of Reform UK Limited, who made many of these decisions himself.
That was greeted with a shake of the head from Robert Jenrick. His former colleague, James Cleverly, called the scale of delays unprecedented and said millions of people were being denied the right to vote. He accused Steve Reid of wanting to cancel all of the local elections, but lacking the courage of his convictions.
Why was his department putting pressure on councils to ask for cancellations as late as last night? I know why. He knows why. We all know why. It's because he wants to shift the blame. He wants to say, I didn't make them do it. He wants a political gotcha.
Steve Reid said he'd impose nothing and called the process a locally led approach. The Labour chair of the Local Government Committee, Florence Eshalomi, challenged the minister.
Our councils should not have to face having to choose between frontline services or elections. Democracy is not an inefficiency that should be cut out, and every council should have the resources to run local elections.
For the Liberal Democrats, Alison Bennett said the decision to postpone elections meant some councillors would serve for 6 years rather than four.
When public trust in politicians is low, it can never be right for those who are up for re-election to decide whether they want to face their electorate. Today's decision undermines trust in elections and in democracy. Surely the Secretary of State can see that this plays into the hands of those who want to undermine our democratic institutions.
Five councils won't be holding elections for the second year running. Reform UK's Robert Jenrick said when he was local government secretary, he'd been advised that it wasn't legally sustainable to put off elections 2 years in a row.
Hence, we didn't. Even during COVID, we kept the elections going, did not delay for 2 years. What the Secretary of State is doing is almost certainly illegal.
The minister quoted Robert Jenrick's comments from 2021 after he'd delayed elections in areas where councils were due to be abolished. He'd said then that it would be hard to justify electing councillors for shortened terms. Steve Reid said Robert Jenrick had got it right for once and should be proud of himself.
And Sean Cohen reporting, it's 12 minutes to seven.
Let us turn to the government's plans that it introduced some time ago to insulate your home. That is what people were told. Two schemes were started. More than 30,000 homes that were improved, in inverted commas, were actually damaged to the extent that people are living with damp and mould still created by botched work. The BBC's Zoe Conway has reported on this story on many occasions. Atif Rashid's mother, Bushra, lives in a home that had been very badly affected by a dam. He talked to us back in October about the impact.
It's been progressively getting worse over the last 10 years. Every heavy downfall, it's really affected the condition of the inside of the house. Lots of water leaking in, and it's actually mentally and physically affected the health of my mother, who lives there on a permanent basis. She's now in her mid-70s, and this has caused her a lot of stress and pain over the years. She's kind of confined to one main room in the property. She almost kind of feels she can't be free in her own home.
That is Atif Rashid. Let us talk to the Public Account Committee's chair, Sir Geoffrey Clifton-Brown, who is on the line now. The Public Accounts Committee, of course, that very powerful cross-party committee of MPs, which is very much on the warpath over all of this. Sir Geoffrey, good morning.
Good morning to you.
What went wrong?
Well, this scheme, which is known as ECO4 and GIBS, was a means-tested scheme. So this was a scheme for the poorest and most disadvantaged in society to insulate their homes. And in the 12 years I've been on the Public Accounts Committee, I have never known such a large percentage of errors in any government scheme, because 98% of all the exterior installations, that's 23,000 homes, and almost a third of the interior installations, another 10,000 homes. So we're talking a total of 30,000 homes that have got defects from this scheme. Some of them, as you were hearing in your run-up to this clip, serious mould and damp problems, creating health problems for those that live in those homes. And the worst thing about all this scheme is it started in 2022. The government only really seriously started to know about it in 2024. And only 3,000 out of those 30,000 homes have so far been remedied. And much more importantly, the government simply haven't traced a very large numbers of these homeowners to find out where they are and what help they need.
God. So, I mean, it goes across governments and across parties and goes, I suppose, to our ability to do things, which is very much in the news all the time at the moment, isn't it? What was it originally, do you think, that went wrong? What was it about the scheme that encouraged, in effect, these awful things to happen?
Well, can I just gently correct one thing you said there, across government? This is not across government. This is purely the Department of Energy Security and Science, so-called DESNES. They were purely responsible for this scheme. And bizarrely, they'd run successful schemes previously, but this scheme, they completely redesigned. They made it hideously complicated. There are large numbers of bodies involved, and each of those bodies blamed the other one. And so the government really didn't know what was going on in their own backyard for at least 2 years.
But I meant governments of particular political stripes. Yeah, no, it's not a political point that you're making. The point, isn't it?
No, yeah, it was introduced by a Conservative government, but certainly this government should have discovered what was going on quicker. And as I say, bizarrely, they redesigned this scheme, making it hideously complicated with a large number of different bodies involved, each blaming each other. And the government didn't know until 2024 that there was a problem. And and now they're struggling to catch up. They've ended the scheme in the budget. They are carrying it on for another 9 months to try and sort it out. But we are very, very worried that there will be people who will not be properly remediated still left at the end of the scheme.
Can I ask you this in a word, Sir Geoffrey? We've just had Ed Miliband, the Energy Secretary, on the other day announcing this new scheme for people, particularly on lower incomes, to have solar panels attached to their tops of their houses. Now, albeit that may do less damage, I suppose, to the house itself. Are you convinced that that scheme that he has now announced will work properly?
Well, we are very concerned. This is a new scheme called the Warm Home Scheme. It's a £15 billion scheme, so it's going to involve a lot of households. And unless the department radically up their game and do much better than the previous scheme, there has to be a risk that there will be people out there who don't receive proper installation. And indeed, I would assume that some of the same installers that installed this insulation under the previous scheme will be doing it under this new scheme as well.
Sir Geoffrey Clifton-Brown, thank you very much.
7 minutes to 7, will Andy Burnham decide to quit as the Mayor of Greater Manchester to stand as an MP and ultimately try to challenge Sir Keir Starmer for the Labour leadership? That question might make it sound simple, but it isn't. Jennifer Williams is Northern correspondent for the Financial Times. Before that, she was at the Manchester Evening News. Morning, Jennifer.
Good morning.
Lots of different things to consider, lots of moving parts. Andy Burnham yesterday, well, he didn't say much. He said people shouldn't rush to conclusions, but this is a complicated calculation, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I don't think there's any question that he has held ambitions to go back to Westminster if he can get to the top of the party for a long time. I mean, you know, going back, I can remember it being fairly clear from when he was re-elected in 2021 from the comments that he made that essentially if MPs came knocking, he would be open to it. So I don't think there's any question that the ambition is there. And I think secondly, in order to get back, there's probably not going to be many windows of opportunity. So the fact that there is now a parliamentary seat come vacant on his own patch because Gorton and Denton MP Andrew Gwynn has sort of said that he's going to stand down, I think means that it's more likely than not that you're going to see some attempt by Burnham to get selected in that seat.
You said there, if MPs come knocking, which is another complication here. Are they coming knocking for him? Because it looks like certainly allies of Sir Keir Starmer are planning to slam the door in his face.
Well, I think the level of sort of personal animosity from Number 10 towards Andy Burnham, I think it's not possible to overstate it. You know, this is really, really visceral how much Number 10 do not want Andy Burnham back in Westminster. So I dare say they will use every mechanism available to them to stop him from coming back. I think in terms of the Parliamentary Labour Party, I've not detected enormous amounts of enthusiasm in terms of we really want Andy Burnham because Andy Burnham is going to be an amazing Prime Minister, if I'm honest. However, MPs will be making a number of calculations. Prime amongst them, can I keep my seat at the next general election? How do I hold on to my majority? And it may well be that they are looking at Andy Burnham and thinking, well, you know, this cannot go on as things are, and he's a better bet than what we've got at the moment. So, you know, I dare say for a number of different political reasons within the Labour Party, there may be enough support there for him to be able to mount a challenge.
And Greater Manchester itself is key in all of this, because if he does leave that job as mayor, well, it will trigger an expensive election to replace him one way or another. And there's no guarantee Labour would win that.
There's no guarantee that Labour would win that. You know, it's untested really in many respects, but there's no reason to think that Reform couldn't have a pretty good shot at it. I think also it's worth pointing out that Andrew Gwynn's seat itself, which is the one that Andy Burnham would be, you know, potentially standing in, it's not an absolute given that Andy Burnham would win that. I mean, from speaking to people, the expectation is that he probably would, because he's Andy Burnham and he's got his own personal brand. But on a kind of Labour electoral level, there's lots of reasons to think that the vote in that seat would splinter all over the place. And yes, you would need to run. If he were to win it, you would need to run a by-election for the Greater Manchester mayoralty, which is possibly one of the reasons that Labour's machinery might use as a reason to say, no, you know, it's going to be ridiculously expensive to also have to run a by-election. So, you know, if they're going to stop him from standing in that seat, they presumably will need to come up with some kind of pretext. And yeah, one of the pretexts may be the cost of having to run a by-election as well.
Yeah, there's a lot to consider. Thanks for laying it all out for us. Jennifer Williams, who's Northern correspondent for the Financial Times.
3 minutes to 7 is the time. Dark Gothic fiction comes to Radio 4 this weekend.
BBC Radio 4's Story of America.
A few miles yet before you reach Sleepy Hollow.
Have you heard the tale of Ichabod Crane?
I figured I was a stranger in a city I hardly knew. We should be open to these things, shouldn't we?
I heard he would often wake in the night screaming.
A new twist on a classic ghost story.
He told people that he dreamt of some kind of demon.
Rumors. Everyone knows something.
The Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
Why do you not have a head?
This Sunday afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Let's check the weather. Here's Simon King.
Anna, thanks so much indeed. The unsettled weather continues across the UK. Today, we've got some strong winds and some rain moving its way in from the south, all linked into actually Storm Ingrid, which was named by the Portuguese Weather Service for the impacts expected there. But it will bring us some really quite strong winds to the southwest of England. There will be some large waves, coastal overtopping as well. And the rain is already with you across southern areas of England. It's just going to move its way further northward across Wales, the Midlands, eastern areas of England, and that will break up gradually into the afternoon. There might be a few bright spells developing, but further heavy showers with some thunderstorms coming in across the far southwest. Now, for northern England, quite cloudy this morning, some outbreaks of rain affecting the far north. We'll see some showers developing over the Pennines, but temperatures across England and Wales today getting to about 6 to 10 degrees. Now, for Northern Ireland, rain is clearing away from the north at the moment. There'll be a few bright spells for time. The cloud then thickens with some rain moving its way in later this afternoon, highs of 7 or 8 degrees. And for Scotland, the heavy rain continues in the northeast of Scotland, with some cold air digging in as well, some snow over the Grampians. Also really quite wet at the moment across southern Scotland. That rain will continue for time, but northwest Scotland drier and brighter, temperatures of 3 to 6 Celsius.
That you are listening to today on BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 23rd of January. The headlines this morning: negotiators from Russia, Ukraine and the US are meeting in Abu Dhabi later as moves to end the war in Ukraine gain momentum. But the issue of territory remains a major sticking point. President Trump is facing criticism after claiming NATO troops, including British forces, stayed off the front lines in Afghanistan. And the Australian commissioner, who introduced the social media ban there for under-16s, has told the BBC she is working closely with UK regulators.
You can do many things with a phone, so you don't know if you're doing it for good or doing it for bad.
Now, that wasn't her. That was one of the 12-year-olds we were hearing from yesterday about their screen time. So we're going to talk to their parents later in the programme, indeed at 7:30, to seeing whether they're doing anything better or indeed worse. We'll also be looking at whether we need fewer police forces, the government planning to cut many of them. Why? The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
Diplomatic efforts to end the war in Ukraine are gathering pace, with negotiators from Kyiv set to join Russian and US officials in what President Zelensky says will be their first trilateral talks. The discussions in the United Arab Emirates over the next 2 days follow a high-level meeting in Moscow last night between President Putin and a US delegation, including President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff. Mr. Trump has said everyone is making concessions to get a deal done. From Moscow, here's our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg.
According to the Kremlin, the discussions in Moscow were substantive, constructive and very frank. But there was no agreement on the key sticking point, territory. After the meeting, President Putin's foreign policy aide Yuri Ushakov said the US envoys had been told that without resolution of the territorial issue, there could be no long-term peace in Ukraine. He gave no details, but Moscow has been demanding that Ukraine cede those parts of the Donbass region still under Kyiv's control, Ukrainian land that Russia has failed to seize in nearly 4 years of war. Mr. Ushakov said President Putin had made it clear that until a diplomatic solution could be achieved, Russia would continue to pursue the objectives of its special military operation. This, he said, was especially true on the battlefield.
Speaking after talks with Donald Trump yesterday, President Zelensky said the remaining issue to resolve was all about the land. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford has the latest from Kyiv.
These first trilateral talks are a kind of crunch time. As Volodymyr Zelensky puts it, they're a chance to see whether Moscow is really serious about peace or just playing games. There is, of course, no trust for Vladimir Putin at all here. After almost 4 years of all-out war, Russian missile and drone attacks are targeting civilian energy infrastructure with renewed intensity, right in the depths of winter, trying to freeze Ukraine into submission. But the big and public sticking point in talks for now is still land, Russia's demand to be gifted areas it's failed to win through fighting. Politicians often talk about red lines, but Ukraine's line in the eastern Donbass region is drawn in soldiers' blood, and Volodymyr Zelensky is adamant he won't cross it.
The European Union has said it will defend itself against any form of coercion after President Trump withdrew his threat to levy tariffs on US allies who oppose his plan to take over Greenland. Speaking after an emergency meeting of EU leaders in Brussels last night, the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, also announced plans for what she called a substantive package of investments for Greenland. Here's our Europe correspondent Nick Beek.
President Trump's partial climb down on Greenland on the eve of this emergency summit eased the pressure from what was a spiralling transatlantic crisis. But for leaders, a line had already been crossed, with Mr. Trump's willingness to take his favoured tool of tariffs and then threaten allies for standing up for the principle of territorial integrity. The EU, bruised by the last week, is insisting a united front, much tougher language towards the US, and the prospect of a hefty economic counterstrike made Mr. Trump think again. In the end, Europe did not have to put its money where its mouth was on retaliatory tariffs, and it was the bilateral meeting with the NATO chief, Mark Rutte, that seemingly catapulted Mr. Trump into his U-turn. It's still not clear what the president believes he was offered, nor whether it will ultimately satisfy his Arctic ambitions.
President Trump is at the centre of fresh criticism after he claimed NATO troops had stayed a little back off the front lines during the war in Afghanistan. Speaking to Fox News, he renewed his criticism of the alliance, saying he wasn't sure it would be there if the US needed it. More than 450 British service personnel were killed during the Afghan conflict. The Labour chair of the Commons Foreign Affairs Committee, Dame Emily Thornberry, told BBC Question Time the remarks were outrageous.
It's an absolute insult. It's an insult to 457 families who lost someone in Afghanistan. How dare he say we weren't on the front line?
The Australian Internet Safety Regulator, who introduced the country's social media ban for under-16s, has said she's working closely with the UK authorities. Sir Keir Starmer has announced a consultation on implementing a similar ban and is facing pressure from some MPs to act immediately. Julie Inman-Grant has been speaking to our correspondent in Sydney, Katie Watson.
Julie Inman-Grant admitted that standing up to big tech companies with deep pockets could be intimidating, and she said she received regular death threats. But just over a month into Australia's social media ban for the under-16s, she's not deterred. Recent data released by the eSafety Commission shows that in the first 2 days of the ban, 4.7 million accounts were closed on the 10 platforms targeted by the legislation, which include YouTube, TikTok, Instagram and Snapchat. Ms. Inman-Grant said several other countries were considering following Australia's lead, and she was in regular contact with the UK regulator Ofcom. She said children needed to be protected.
With these systems that are literally built to keep them entrenched and entranced, it's just not a fair fight. To make their platform safer and to keep kids away until they're ready is, I think, that monumental circuit breaker move. And if other countries do that, then we have a network effect.
Ms. Inman-Grant said now the ban was in place, her team was looking at how the companies were complying with the law, with the possibility of imposing fines of as much as £25 million on those not doing enough to keep under-16s off platforms.
TikTok has completed a multi-billion pound deal that establishes a separate American subsidiary of the video sharing platform in order to avoid a ban in the US. In 2024, Congress passed a law stating that the Chinese-owned app should either be sold to an American buyer or banned, citing national security concerns over its ties to the government in Beijing. The BBC has discovered there are more than 500 illegal dumps operating across England, with at least 11 huge sites containing more than 20,000 tonnes of waste. Police say many are linked to organised crime gangs. Residents living nearby say more needs to be done to clean them up and protect the environment. Our Rural Affairs correspondent Jenny Kumar reports.
More than 740 illegal tips were shut down last year, but there were still more than 500 others in use in December, according to Environment Agency data. Many of them are in the countryside. Some have been operating for years. Among the largest are a 280,000-tonne site in Cheshire and two 50,000-tonne sites in Lancashire and Cornwall. Campaigners say not enough has been done to stop the illegal activities and to clean up the sites, even when those responsible have been prosecuted. The Environment Agency said it was committed to tackling waste crime and trying to disrupt those who profited from it.
More details have been released of the National Memorial to Queen Elizabeth II, which will be built in St James's Park in London. There will be a new sculpture and the main statue will show the late Queen standing rather than on horseback. Here's our royal correspondent Sean Coughlin.
Unlike the illustrations that suggested that the horse-loving Queen might be depicted riding, an update on the statue now says she'll be shown standing. The sculptor, Martin Jennings, says that after careful research, it was decided that this official memorial would show the late Queen as a head of state. The Memorial Committee and Cabinet Office have also announced there'll be another smaller sculpture in the park, which will be made by the celebrated artist Karen Newman. She once worked making models for Madame Tussauds, with Prince Philip among the subjects of her waxworks.
Sean Coughlin reporting.
Thank you, Jane. It is 9 minutes past seven. The first trilateral talks between Ukraine, Russia and the US to try to end the war will happen in Abu Dhabi later today after President Zelensky's meeting with President Trump at Davos and US envoy Steve Witkoff's trip to Moscow. But land and who will control it after any ceasefire is still one of the main sticking points when it comes to actually reaching a deal. Another is President Putin's continuing reluctance to agree to one. It is another change of foreign policy focus for the Trump administration, which has been preoccupied with taking control of Greenland for the last couple of weeks and a potential military attack on Iran before that. Well, I've been speaking to Robert Wilkie, who was Veterans Affairs Secretary in President Trump's first administration and took charge of the Pentagon transition for the second, about whether he thinks the war in Ukraine is any closer to ending.
Well, I am not an optimist on this. I think Putin is in this to the death. I think the only thing that stops him is a totally massive defeat on the battlefield. I think he's committed. I think he's stringing these things along, as Russians tend to do. So we'll see. But I have absolutely no confidence that Putin will concede on any major points in these negotiations, and he'll just be playing for time until the spring comes.
Do you think the US administration genuinely believes that he wants to reach a negotiated settlement here? Because again, we're getting these positive noises coming from the US, but that it doesn't really match anything that we've seen so far in terms of the discussions, right?
My current colleague and former envoy to Ukraine, General Kellogg, probably going too far in speaking for him, but I know he was very frustrated that people didn't take Putin at his word. And his word has been for 30 years that he wants to subsume Ukraine. And I do think that there is a problem on the American right. And I think you see some of it on the far right parties in Europe, on the continent, that they look at Russia as somehow bizarrely standing for a Western civilization that no longer exists. I don't mean to get too deep into this, but I've seen it play out here, that because Putin stands next to the patriarch every Orthodox Christmas, these people believe that he represents faith, family, and freedom, when you and I know in the history of Europe that the patriarch's probably on the payroll of the secret police, just like his grandfather and great-grandfather were on the payroll of the Tsar's secret police. And we see nothing but traditional Russian barbarity. Your own MOD is saying that they're losing dead 25,000 people a month. Now, we lost 53,000 dead in Vietnam over 10 years. That's the scale of what they're doing.
President Trump's attention towards Ukraine seems to come and go. Do you think if he really focused on it for a sustained period of time that he could break through here? Is it that he keeps losing interest when it reveals itself to be once again such an intractably slow problem to sort out?
Yeah, it is. And there's so much going on the American plate. We're seeing the greatest threat to the Ayatollah's regime since 1979 when they came to power. We're seeing the disintegration of a problem that has vexed American presidents since Eisenhower in Cuba. We think that regime is on its last legs. And we have Venezuela as well as Ukraine, and now with Greenland. I don't know that Ronald Reagan or Mrs. Thatcher could devote so much time to any one of these particular issues had they been facing them. So yes, it's a massive problem that comes as a result of American power, but American power having to focus on so many different parts of the world.
Let's talk about Greenland for a moment, which has really dominated U.S. foreign policy conversations for the last week, 10 days. Do you think that's gone away for now?
I hope so. I think we were on the precipice of fulfilling Vladimir Putin's wildest dreams. I mean, the dreams of every Bolshevik and now kleptocrat, and that was to separate the Atlantic Alliance in two, remove the United States, at least looking at the rhetoric. In some quarters, and you know, we're right back at square one. We've had a treaty with Greenland since 1951. It was signed by Harry Truman. My own uncle commanded a small Air Force base on Greenland in the late 50s and early 60s. We can do as much as we want on Greenland. Have been able to do that for well over 70 years. And we are, by treaty, equally responsible for Greenland's security, as is Denmark. So I hope we focus on this, because the real danger to us all is Russia and more importantly, China.
Robert Wilkie, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And that brings us to 7:15. The EU is going to defend itself against any coercion, according to the man who runs the European Council, Antonio Costa. He says the European Union, and I quote now, will continue to stand up for its interests and will defend itself, its member states, its citizens, its companies against any form of coercion. It has the power and the tools to do so, and will do so if and when necessary. He was speaking, of course, as Donald Trump was safely on his way home to Washington, D.C. Let's talk to Katja Adler, BBC's Europe editor, who is on the line. Quite striking words, Katja.
Definitely a real change in tone. I mean, it was interesting, Justin, because it's not as if Europe's leaders don't have anything to do at the moment. This is a very busy time domestically, internationally. This summit here in Brussels was hastily convened at the real height of the Greenland crisis, when Donald Trump was, you know, he had military measures on the table and economic measures on the table to kind of grab Greenland unilaterally. Even though the heat has now gone at that crisis, those leaders decided to meet anyway, and for 5 hours. And that is because there's a real sense in Europe of a before and after, a very somber mood in the room as they were discussing transatlantic relations going forward. Because I think even those who are more glass half full towards Washington, like Italy, or glass half empty, like France, there was a sense that if Donald Trump did it once, he turned on a fellow NATO ally, Denmark in this case, threatened its sovereignty, threatened other allies with economic sanctions unless they got in their box and let him get on with it, he can do it again. He could do it again over Greenland, because the details of a deal still need to be negotiated, or anything else in the future if he wants to get his way. And that led the leaders to talk about strategic changes. And that goes, there echoes what you were saying from Antonio Costa, the European Council president, who was the host last night, a debate of change in attitude towards Washington. Because we know, we've talked about it, Europe's leaders till now have kind of favoured this softly, softly approach with Donald Trump, cajoling him, trying to keep him on side because they need the United States for continental security and over Ukraine if there's ever going to be a lasting peace there. But France, Spain and others are convinced that Donald Trump only backed down from his unilateral measures over Greenland because they threatened tough economic sanctions. They stood tall and they stood tough, and they think that's what they will need to do with him going forward, to be more transactional and more cool-headed. But also, there was a lot of talk last night about more self-reliance in Europe. And, you know, Europe's talked about this for a long time. But now it's not just about talking the talk. They feel they need to walk the walk. It's not just that they've relied so much on the US for defense. They've relied on China to buy its goods. They had relied on Russia for cheap energy. So Europe needs to be more self-reliant. These leaders talked about in defense, in technology, and more going forward. So yeah, as I say, a real sense of a before and after.
It's an interesting one then, Katja, to think about what actually has changed and what you're suggesting they think has changed potentially or should change. change potentially is actually it's more within Europe, isn't it, rather than the attitudes to America. It's what Europeans actually do themselves and what the Union does itself.
It's a realization, I think, amongst a lot of these leaders. I think you hear all of these analogies. It was like a slap in the face. It was like a bucket of ice being poured over our heads, that it was sort of a real shock. And that, yes, Europe needs to change, a lot of these leaders are saying, but they think that's the world that's changing. It's not just a change of attitude in the White House from Donald Trump as regards transatlantic relations, but that we are now in a world of big power politics where China, Russia, and yes, the US and others are competing for territory or for treasures like rare earths and minerals that Greenland, for example, is so rich. And this sense that Europe needs to kind of buck up and get more realistic in this world about sticking together where it can. And that's not just about the EU, but it's working together with the UK, within NATO, or areas of mutual interest. I think, you know, we heard from Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister, this week speaking at the World Economic Forum. And he was saying, in this world, middle powers, if they don't stick together, they don't have a seat at the table, they'll be on the menu. And there was a sense of that in the talk between EU leaders last night.
Yeah, and we will discuss with Sir Alex Younger, the former head of MI6, what practical measures, what practical changes might come from all of this at 10 past 8. For the time being, Katja Adler, thank you.
It's 19 minutes past 7 now. TikTok has completed a multi-billion pound deal to create a separate American subsidiary. This deal happened to basically avoid a US ban on the social media app because of national security concerns. Zoe Kleinman is our technology editor, joins us now. Morning, Zoe. Before we talk about what they've done, let's just talk about the backstory to this, because this has been around for a while, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. That's right. So President Donald Trump has said on social media that he saved TikTok. But let's remember that actually he was the one who put TikTok into jeopardy in the first place by floating the idea of a ban back in 2020. And that's been because of ongoing national security concerns. He and Joe Biden after him have repeatedly said they're worried about perceived connections with the Chinese government because of TikTok's parent company, ByteDance. This has been going on for a long time. We've had lots of moments where there were deadlines, and if TikTok hadn't been sold to American investors, it was going to be banned in the US. This went on, and then somehow the deadline came and went, and an extension came in. ByteDance, which owns TikTok, didn't want to give it up. Of course, it's owned by 200 million, it's used by 200 million Americans. They didn't really want to give it up either. So there was this kind of stalemate for quite a long time. And what seems to have happened now is that the sale has been agreed. So it's going to be owned by a number of companies, most of them American. The biggest stakeholders, if you like, are Oracle and Silver Lake, which are US investment firms, and an investor firm called MGX, which is based in Abu Dhabi and has also invested in Elon Musk's company, XAI. So it's definitely in the sort of US tech space, if you like.
And in theory, although we don't know yet how this will work in practice, there might be some changes inside the app. For example, the algorithm and how that works is going to be a bit different.
So the algorithm is really described as TikTok's secret sauce. And that is the tech that keeps you on it. It keeps serving you up content based on what you've interacted with before, based on what it thinks you will like. And you know, a lot of people say it's just very, very good. It's very sharp. And while other platforms, they all use algorithms, right, to try and hold our attention, to try and figure out what will keep us on the app for longer, because that's how we see more ads and that's how the company makes more money. But TikTok's has just been very, very good. And ByteDance, the parent company, had said it wouldn't give it up. You know, it was so important to it, and it belongs to it. It's its intellectual property, that it wouldn't give it up. And a lot of people said, well, without it, you know, a sort of US version of TikTok, if you like, won't be very good. But it seems like it has now agreed to give up the rights to that algorithm. It will be trained on US data only. So it will be an algorithm that will only, if you like, work in the US based on what US citizens are doing on the app. Now, is that going to be any good? Is it going to lose the sort of global trend thing that it mirrors at the moment? Well, we don't know. We'll have to see how it works, whether it will be slower, and when it will start to kick in, if Americans who are on TikTok notice a difference.
Yeah, it will be interesting, won't it? Zoe Kleinman, our technology editor, thank you.
It is 22 minutes past seven. The latest retail sales figures from the Office for National Statistics out this morning, in fact, less than half an hour ago. They show that retail sales rose by 0.4% in December. Leanne Byrne has more on that. I don't know whether that's good, bad, indifferent or what. Hello, Leanne.
It's good. Thanks, Justin. It's above expectations, and that reversed falls in October and November as shoppers did spend more in the run-up to Christmas. But then, if you zoom out, and I think this is important for context, the picture is softer. Across the whole of the final quarter, sales volumes actually fell by 0.3%. And there's also a clear split. Food sales edged up in December, but non-food spending actually fell. So things like clothing, household, it was down 0.9%. Joining me now, Nick Stowe, Chief Executive of Monsoon Accessorize. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning.
So, more positive than expected, but is it the food retailers who carried that? Is it difficult being a retailer that isn't selling food right now?
It is difficult, but you know, I think we'll take all of the good news that we can. I think the further away from the budget that we get in November, you know, confidence seems to be increasing. We're seeing better results in January, so I think confidence is coming back, and we should be happy about that. You know, it is still tough, but it certainly seems to be edging up.
Have you had to heavily discount this January to clear stock?
We haven't done anything really unusual. We bought quite keenly for our autumn winter season, so we haven't had that much stock to clear. You know, we've been quite thoughtful about it. You know, we anticipated it was not going to be a bumper year, and so we haven't had to discount that heavily. You know, I think the market has been very promotional, and people have certainly picked up some bargains, I'm sure, you know, during the January sales.
Now, changes to business rates are coming in April. Will that hit you? And is it tough when costs are rising and at the same time you've got overseas platforms like Shein and Temu? They can ship into the UK with fewer costs.
Yeah, you know, it is very tough. I mean, you've read a lot about the pushback on rates. You know, I think our rates have always been high. They're still high. We're not in quite as bad a position as the hospitality folks, where they're seeing crazy increases. You know, but our job's to battle through it, you know, have a good business in you know, tough times and fantastic times. So we're well place for it. I think we've been really thoughtful about managing our costs, and we're quite aggressive about that, you know, using technology to offset some of these cost increases. The overseas folks, the, you know, Shein and Temu, that is frustrating. You know, it doesn't hit us that hard, but you've got, you know, folks who are avoiding custom duties, not paying all their VAT, bringing in product that doesn't meet the standards in the UK. So I think, you know, people are very, very frustrated about that, and it's high time to stop it. It's not helping UK retailers.
Okay, Nick Stowe, Chief Executive of Monsoon Accessorize. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Leanna. It is 26 minutes past seven. Mike's back with the sport.
Thank you, Anna. We are awaiting the arrival of Cameron Norrie on court in Melbourne. The last remaining Brit in the singles at the Australian Open takes on Alex Zverev in the third round in the next 20 minutes or so. Abigail Johnson will be watching on. She joins us live now. Abigail, worth reminding people that Norrie does not have a good record against the German Zverev.
That is true. At tour level, it is 6-0 in the favour of last year's finalist, although Zverev not in his most convincing form, even as the number three seed. And when they faced off at the fourth round stage in Melbourne Park 2 years ago, Norrie was able to push him the distance to a final set tiebreak in the fifth. They are waiting on the culmination of the match currently on John Cain Arena, and that has 18-year-old Iva Jovic, the number 29 seed, leading Jasmine Paolini, two-time Grand Slam finalist, by a set and a break.
Coverage from Melbourne continues right now with the Tennis Breakfast over on BBC Sounds, and we'll be back there in the next hour of the programme. Meanwhile, England will name their squad for next month's Six Nations later this morning. Plenty of talking points ahead of that, so let's bring in Rugby Union correspondent Chris Jones, who joins us. Morning, Chris.
Morning, Mike. How's it going?
Yeah, we're okay. Loads then to pick over ahead of this squad announcement, particularly a prop. Bit of an injury crisis there for England.
Yeah, a couple of injuries on the tight head side for Steve Borthwick, the England boss, to deal with. Will Stewart, Asha Opoku-Fajor both out. So we can expect him to turn to the Bath 20-year-old tight head Billy Seller hasn't had loads of game time at the Rec for obvious reasons. Some great players in that position ahead of him at Bath, but has been tipped for the top for a while, and he's bang in line for a call-up when the squad's announced late morning today. Elsewhere, the Exeter number 8, Greg Fisselau, look out for him. He's been pulling up trees at Sandy Park this season, and that number 8 position perhaps a little bit open with Tom Willis out of contention. But on the whole, I think quite a settled England squad with Steve Borthwick's team going so well last year.
Yeah, 11 wins on the spin for Borthwick's England. How will they be feeling ahead of this Six Nations? I note they only have the two games at home this time around, but will they fancy themselves to win a first title since 2020?
Yeah, they've got to. They've got to be buoyant, Mike. As you say, on a great run, winning all those games last year, 11 in a row. A couple of injuries they would like to get right, whether it's Ollie Lawrence or Finn Smith or Finn Baxter, Tom Roebuck. So a few players are touch and go for that first game against Wales. But Wales at home, given where Wales are, is a good start. And then two decisive games, really. That Scotland game away, Ireland at home before the rest week. And then they go on the road to play Italy and France. So as ever with the Six Nations, incredibly competitive. Winning any title is going to be hard for. But England will certainly start this one as one of the clear favourites.
Less than a fortnight to go till it all gets underway on the 5th of February. Chris Jones, many thanks for that. Elsewhere this morning, England's cricketers are 1-0 down in their three-match one-day series against Sri Lanka after losing the first match by 19 runs in Colombo yesterday. In football, Aston Villa have guaranteed a top eight league phase finish in the Europa League with a game to spare after a 1-0 win away to Fenerbahce yesterday. Nottingham Forest's future, though, still in the balance after they lost 1-0 at Braga. Celtic's 2-2 draw in Bologna means they can still reach the knockout, but Rangers are now definitely out. Finally, it's not just Donald Trump who's been speaking at Davos this week. His great friend, the FIFA president Gianni Infantino, made a speech there yesterday. But he has been criticised for taking a swipe in that speech at the reputation of travelling British football fans. He was looking back at the last World Cup in Qatar in 2022 when he said this.
For the first time in history, also, no Brit was arrested during a World Cup. Imagine, this is something really, really special. So,
and there has been a bit of criticism for the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino, after that comment. In response, the Football Supporters Association said that Mr. Infantino, instead of making cheap jokes, should make cheap tickets available for the tournament in North America later this year.
Mike, thank you.
This is our BBC. It can take us anywhere.
I hear we're going down the beach.
Raise questions.
So let's try and join all the dots.
Bring us down to Earth.
Floating in a spacesuit.
We can share it with others.
Children need are going to help so many people with that money.
Or keep it to ourselves.
Mr. Shelby will always be alone.
Join millions of people.
Live at the Royal Albert Hall, where we are.
Building our future.
The BBC has put £5 billion into the economy.
There's a BBC for each of us, funded by all of us.
Much to discover.
This is our BBC.
Take a look at the weather today, which will be cloudy overall with spells of rain, but do watch out for some rain and hill snow as well, actually, on the way in the northeast of Scotland.
In the next half hour, do we need fewer police forces in England and Wales? The government is planning to cut many of them. We'll discuss whether that is the right move, how indeed it leads to lower crime. We'll be discussing it with a former assistant commissioner of the Met.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford. It's 29 minutes to 8. Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
Discussions between Russian, Ukrainian and American officials on ending the war in Ukraine will take place in the United Arab Emirates later. Russia confirmed the talks after a late-night meeting in Moscow between the US envoy Steve Witkoff and President Putin. The Kremlin described that meeting as useful, but warned that a durable peace would not be possible unless territorial issues were resolved. The European Union has said it will defend itself against any form of coercion after President Trump withdrew his threat to levy tariffs on US allies who opposed his plan to take over Greenland. After talks in Brussels, it was also announced that the EU would invest more into security in the Arctic. The Australian regulator who introduced a social media ban for under-16s has told the BBC she is in regular contact with her counterparts in the UK. Julie Inman-Grant said the effect could be monumental if other countries joined suit. The BBC has discovered there are more than 500 illegal rubbish dumps operating across England, with at least 11 huge sites containing more than 20,000 tonnes of waste. Campaigners say not enough has been done to stop illegal dumping or to clean them up. The Environment Agency said it was committed to tackling waste crime and trying to disrupt those who profited from it. Official figures show that UK retail sales bounced back last month in a better-than-expected performance over Christmas. The Office for National Statistics said that the quantity of goods bought was estimated to have risen by 0.4% in December. More details have been released of the National Memorial to Queen Elizabeth II, which will be built in St James's Park in London. It's been disclosed the main statue will show the late Queen standing rather than on horseback, as previously illustrated.
Thank you for that. 27 minutes to 8 is the time. You may remember yesterday we spoke to Sophia, Faith and Alex, three year eight pupils at a school in Sunderland, about what impact a ban on social media might have on them. We did so, of course, because, as we've just been hearing, an Australia ban is very much on the cards here, and the Lords has just backed one. The government is said to be thinking about it. The discussion ended with the Mole making a rather embarrassing confession about his own screen time.
I'm actually ashamed to say it's 5 hours and 2 minutes. What do you think of that, Alex?
I'll say, don't know how to explain it. I have mixed feelings because you can do many things with a phone, so you don't know if you're doing it for good or doing it for bad.
I think it's good compared to other people because other people that I've seen on TikTok have got like 12 hours.
Wow. Okay. I mean, that is definitely too much. Do you know what? It makes me think that maybe the problem is not so much kids and social media, but adults and social media.
A question. Is he right? So we thought we'd talk to the parents, actually, to see if the problem really is adults. And two of them are with me now. Kimberly Webster Cooper is the mother of Sophia and Alan Devereux, father of Alex. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Kimberly, do you think he's right?
I do and I don't. It's hard because some of the stuff that the children need to use is on the phone for schoolwork. So it's hard to get a gauge of what they're actually doing.
So in other words, if you're not on yourself, you won't have any access to the world that they are in.
Yes, because they're not able to go out anywhere anymore. Like, I used to, when I was younger, to be with friends and socialise. Everything they need to do now to socialise with friends is all on the phone.
Yeah, and what you're talking about is not just schoolwork. It's a wider amount of stuff than that, is it?
It is, yeah. So, when I was younger, we used to be able to go out and go into the Quartry Leisure Centre and spend all day there. But nowadays, there's just nowhere for them to go, to be with the friends and to know that there's a safe place for them to go and spend the day. Or if there is, it costs an absolute fortune. So the resolve to that is they go on WhatsApp or they go on TikTok and they do dances with friends, or they're on the phones talking to the friends while playing games and interacting that way.
Yeah, and your point being that if you're not there as well, in some way, shape or form, you're not going to know what's going on. Alan, do you feel the same way, that it's a place that you have to be?
Yes. You know, my job is to protect my children and to prepare them for life. I think the reality is that children don't live in the street that they were born up in anymore. They live on the internet nowadays. Yes, they can go to the park. Yes, they can see their friends, but with a click of a button, they're in a room full of a million strangers. So it's our job, I think, as responsible parents, to make sure that they are guarded through this. Something that I've done with my children is to make sure that I'm part of that world with them, rather than tell them that they can't, or rather than give them unfettered access. Just as an example, the hotspot password on the hotspot username on my phone is 67, because it's just something that, you know, they find funny, and it makes them realize that I'm kind of with them in the whole thing. So I don't stop them from doing anything. But we, you know, we limit screen time and things like this.
But here's the thing, here's the thing, Alan, do you keep to your own rules? Because I think one of the things Amol was suggesting is that a lot of us, never mind being involved in what the children are looking at, etc., just in using them in our own terms as adults, we don't keep to the rules we suggest to children that they should have, and that actually is a problem.
So when I'm in their company, I do. I mean, let's be honest. You know, we don't have our phones when we watch TV. We don't have our phones when we eat our dinner. We limit ourselves to 3 hours a day. But at 11 o'clock at night, I'm going to pick up my phone. I'm going to start scrolling. And before I know it, an hour and a half is lost on videos. Because that's the way the networks are built. They're built to keep us going, aren't they? It's a continual dopamine loop. We just keep chasing that next video. So in their presence, absolutely, I follow my own rules. But when I'm on my own, I slip into it just like everybody else.
Kimberly, how do you do with rules?
I must be honest, I am guilty of going on my phone to check something and then realising an hour later that I've been scrolling through stuff. So I feel that I'm aware that I can put the telly on and I can be on my phone at the same time, which I have noticed that my children do as well. So I'm trying to make those changes as to where I'm not doing that and to be more present. It is hard when you go on to answer phone calls or text messages and then something pops up and I'm like, oh, I'll just quickly have a look at that. Yeah. And then, like I say, an hour's gone by and I realise that I've only been on my phone.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because that, and I think a lot of people will share that experience that both of you have been very honest about. I hope the children aren't listening. But Kimberly, you do wonder, when you're talking about a social media ban and all the rest of it, in a sense it only works, doesn't it, if it's a societal conversation about the damage to us, potentially, that these algorithms are doing?
Yes, 100%. I think everybody's got to be on board with it. But a total ban I don't really agree with, because there is things that the children can see that can help them. For instance, Sophia has seen recipes on TikTok and things like that, which has then wanted to cook for us. So it's given her a learning experience on how to make things at home and be more independent. So if it was a total ban, she wouldn't be able to find those and get that experience of doing that.
Alan, what's your view on a total ban, the Australia style?
It's very difficult. So I think the information that you can find on TikTok and Facebook, you can find elsewhere. Is when you go onto a social network, which is literally designed to bring strangers together. It's something that they're known for. You encourage your child to interact in a world of strangers. In any physical interaction, you wouldn't allow that. You wouldn't send your child into a football stadium full of strangers without you and say, there you go, spend 2 hours in there. I think it's too big a problem for us to be able to take it apart piece by piece and say, for example, we're going to block this kind of video or we're going to manage this kind of network. I think it's gone too far, and I don't necessarily see the harm in it being a reset. A school can give my child a different way to research something. I can help my child find something. I've been alive for 50 years. I have experience. So it's not as if the knowledge can't come from another source. I think the harm that these networks can do, both with the fact that you can meet a stranger and for the fact that your brain is managed by the way these algorithms work, is far outweighs the negativity that a ban would bring in.
Yeah. There is, of course, the question of just whether people could get past it or children could get past it. And actually, Sophia mentioned that yesterday. Let's see if we can find the clip of Sophia telling Amal how she thought that people could easily get past it.
If you're really, really honest, do you think that ban would work?
I think there will still be people that will find a way around and will use social media still. But then some people will just accept the fact that they cannot do it and not bother.
I mean, that's the other problem, isn't it, Kimberly? Just in the end, we're talking about something, and the Australians are still assessing the impact of what they've tried to do, but something that just won't work.
Yeah. She was right in saying that people will find a way. They always find a way of finding this stuff, where if it's not banned, we'll be able to control and be able to say, not control, but be able to monitor what they're actually watching and what they're seeing, and then be able to deal with that. Where if they find a way around things, we're not going to know what they're doing 24/7 on it. So there could be things that potentially are dangerous that they're watching.
We will see what comes now of the government's discussions about coming up with some sort of firm proposals, which they haven't done yet, but apparently they're intending to do. Kimberly Webster Cooper and Alan Devereux as well, thank you. And I should say TikTok, who we talk to quite a lot about these things, have issued a statement in which they say they took the industry-leading step of introducing a default screen time of 60 minutes for every teen under the age of 18.
It's 17 minutes to 8 now. It is, as we've been telling you all this month, it is the National Year of Reading 2026. So what we've been trying to do is treat you to some stories from some of our most well-known authors about the book that ignited or reignited their love of reading. And they've been very kindly giving us some little excerpts for them from them as well. So today it's the turn of Samantha Harvey, who won the Booker Prize in 2024 for her novel Orbital. And she's chosen Ross Poldark by Winston Graham. It is the first in the famous Poldark series, and it was first published in 1945 by Wardlock & Co.
The book that ignited my love of reading is Ross Poldark by Winston Graham, which is the first in the series of Poldark novels, which I think my mum gave to me when I was about 13 and was probably the first adult fiction I'd ever read independently. It's a book that's set in Cornwall in the 1700s, late 1700s, and it was a completely new world to me, and I remember just falling into it, following the adventures and exploits of its title character, Ross Poldark, who is kind of a man who is, I guess, ahead of his time. He's always fighting the good fight, you know, fighting for justice. He's also, as it happens, a little bit ravishing. And I used to write him letters to my horror. I would spend hours writing letters to him. God knows what they said. I'd hate to read them now. But I think that it was just the fact that I was probably still really a child when I read that book. You know, my brain was malleable and yielding and growing, and the book grew into and around me, and I grew into and around it. And that's what I most remember about it, is this feeling of it being very kind of closely implicated in my life. So the passage I'm going to read is from right at the end of the book, from Ross's point of view. He thought, if we could only stop life for a while, I would stop here. Not when I get home, not leaving Trenwith, but here, reaching the top of the hill out of Saw, dusk wiping out the edges of the land, and Demelza walking and humming at my side. He knew of things plucking at his attention. All existence was a cycle of difficulties to be met and obstacles to be surmounted. But at this evening hour of Christmas Day, 1787, he was not concerned with the future, only the present. He thought, I am not hungry or thirsty or lustful or envious. I am not perplexed or weary or ambitious or remorseful. Just ahead, in the immediate future, there is waiting an open door and a warm house, comfortable chairs and quietness and companionship. Let me hold it. Do you know, I think that Ross Poldark has, for me, and I think it's reflected in that short piece, what I've come to think of as probably the most fundamental, important quality of great writing, which is generosity. It has a kind of roomy, warm, hospitable feel to it. It always lets you in, and it always lets you stay. I've read this novel again as an adult, and in fact, I've read the whole series again, and I've found it to be sort of proper, meaty, plotty, character-led, clever, intricate, gorgeous prose, a gorgeous work of fiction. He's a really classy writer. And I think that it's this warmth and this generosity that keeps drawing me back. And whenever I'm stuck now with reading and I can't get my teeth into anything, I know I can go back into this novel and it will always let me in.
That was Samantha Harvey talking to us. It brings us to 13 minutes to 8. And time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Jane Manfredi, who is the writer and Anglican deacon.
Good morning. You failed. words spoken to me by a man with a clipboard in a Renault Clio back in 1997. Failing my driving test seems trivial now from the misty vantage point of nearly 30 years' distance. But at age 17, these were devastating words to hear. The unpleasant sting of failure is a lingering memory, the embarrassment increasing with each friend calling to say they had passed, the sense of inadequacy, the desperation and the increasing certainty that I would never, ever pass myself. Such is the stigma and social detriment of failure that some people will resort to nefarious means in order to pass. Cheating on driving tests has increased by nearly 50% over the past year, a dangerous form of deception which risks lives and also severs the social contract which relies on us all following the rules in order to be safe. Failure is key both to character building and communal ethics. The biblical record is littered with examples of human failure and those who tried everything to avoid it. The trickster is a common narrative trope, which includes a disreputable collection of characters who cheat and lie in order to succeed, rather than risk the disgrace of failure. Abram, who persuades Sarai to pose as his sister to dupe Pharaoh. Laban, who uses deception to ensnare Jacob into working longer for him. Rebecca, the trickster, architect of the plan to fool Isaac into blessing her younger son Jacob over his brother Esau. These cheats appear to prosper, at least momentarily, in a moral universe which allowed deception. But the biblical record shows that their ethical misdeeds often came back to haunt them. Jacob, for example, so quick to be part of his mother's schemes, ended up being deceived himself, tricked into marrying the wrong woman. The book of Proverbs says that food gained by fraud tastes sweet, but one ends up with a mouth full of gravel. So it was for our biblical tricksters, whom God used to work out his divine purposes, not because God loves a cheater, but because God loves those who fail. It is in the failing and the striving and the trying again that we learn our best lessons. Elizabeth Day has written that if you've survived it, failure has taught you something. I finally passed my driving test, but it was in the failure to do so that I learned how to be a good driver. The taste of failure is bitter indeed, hard to swallow, and takes a long time to uncomfortably digest. But it's what feeds our character and helps us to grow. And however horrible it tastes, at least it's not gravel.
And that was Thought for the Day with Jane Manfredi. It brings us to 10 to 8.
Big changes to policing in England and Wales are set to be laid out by the government next week, among them a significant reduction in the number of individual police forces. We won't know for a while how many, because there's going to be a consultation, or how long the plans will take to come to fruition, but we know it's likely to be quite a few years. The central idea behind this is that larger forces will focus on serious and organised crime, and then smaller policing areas will look at neighbourhood crime. But what are the challenges behind that plan? Well, Helen King joins us, former Assistant Commissioner at the Metropolitan Police. She's also helped to lead the Merseyside and Cheshire forces. Helen, good morning.
Good morning.
You've seen both the big and the small, and the idea of a reduction in the number of forces is by no means new. Do you think that is the solution that's needed here?
Well, you're right. 20 years ago, we thought this was going to happen, and then a change in Home Secretary meant it didn't come about. I think lots of people have looked at this, and there's a growing consensus amongst professionals and people who are informed and impartial that the number of forces currently is not ideal. Policing is getting ever more complex, and the need for specialist units to deal with the range of crimes and other challenges means that the smaller forces aren't sustainable. That's partially been overcome by collaborations and joint units. The National Police Chiefs Council, the Police Foundation and others are clear that at some point we need to move to fewer forces. But the Home Secretary and others really shouldn't underestimate how difficult this is, and that it will take time. It will cost money in the short term. The transition costs money, although you can probably drive out savings longer term. And it'll need, you know, political determination to bring it about, and ideally cross-party working. But whether there's the national or local climate for that is a completely different question.
Yeah, it did happen in Scotland, of course, but one of the great problems, and particularly when it comes to crime, is that people expect and want to see officers around them in their streets and in their town centres. And when we hear about big forces, smaller forces, neighbourhood policing areas, how will that change the way that crime is policed at the level that most of us will see it?
Well, the two aren't in conflict. Local policing, those relationships with local officers and visibility. Police professionals know that that's really important to the public. But in effect, what you have at the moment is it gets diluted because local officers have to be called away to deal with big operations, major crimes, searches for vulnerable people, to do all the complex work of building files and bringing about prosecutions. So if having a larger force means that you can sustain specialist units to take on more of those responsibilities, it actually enables local officers to remain on their patch, building those community relations, responding to local crime, dealing with local criminals more effectively as well. So the two do not have to be in conflict.
You touched on this, but the time frame is also of interest, because the suggestion is that this will not happen until the end of the next parliament, 8 years away, which, you know, raises questions about what will happen to crime in the meantime. Hello, Helen, can you still hear me? Oh, there you are. Now,
yes, I can.
I think we just lost your line for a second there. Sorry about that. But I was just saying, well, you know, in that intervening 8 years, how would we keep crime under control?
Well, as I say, there have been all sorts of workarounds already put in place with collaborations between forces. I think what worries me is that the work gets done to prepare for this major change, and then at some point the political will changes and all that effort then is wasted. It felt a bit like that 20 years ago. No government has been brave enough to go near it since. And the worry is that it's politics that get in the way of actually what is a sensible change, but will take time. And as I say, will also take money and resources in the short term. And so if that's going to be invested, I think everyone would want to see it come to fruition and not get thwarted somewhere en route.
When you talk about politics, is this something that police officers themselves want to see? Because certainly, as you talk about 20 years ago and the mood music changed, it was because those officers involved didn't want to see the merger happening.
Well, I don't think that's entirely accurate. There was a mix of views then. Certainly at a senior level, there's a much clearer consensus now that operationally this is the right thing to do. The National Police Chiefs Council have had that position for quite a while. It's more about politicians and maybe communities who don't necessarily understand all the complexities of policing, wanting to jump to protect a local identity. And of course, amongst individual officers, there will be a mix of views. I joined the police in 1986, and at that point, there were still officers who felt very proud that they were from a different structure pre-1974. That's the last time boundaries changed. So in Cheshire, there were Lancashire officers, former Lancashire officers working in Warrington, working in Widnes and so on, who were proud to carry a collar number that indicated the force they joined initially. So there will be a mix of views. But as I say, my worry is that the work would get started, it would become a distraction that was never actually brought through to completion. And I think the Home Secretary and this government need to weigh up whether their commitment and determination is such that it's worth that investment and they are going to deliver the change that the vast majority of people who've looked at this think is a sensible outcome.
It's an interesting point. And as you say, they're rooted in the very nature of politics, where something 8 years away will have an intervening election, won't it? Helen King, thank you for joining us, a former Assistant Commissioner at the Metropolitan Police.
3 minutes to eight is the time. Alex Forsyth is standing by live because it is Friday. It is Any Questions Day. Where are you, Alex? What's going to happen?
Hello, Justine. Good morning. Well, while this week the eyes of the world have been on events in Davos, we tonight will be in Dorset, specifically the market town of Blandford Forum, giving people the chance to ask what they will about it all. And taking their questions, we have the Labour MP and Justice Minister Jake Richards. John Glenn is Parliamentary Private Secretary to Kemi Badenoch. Anna Sabine is the Liberal Democrat spokesperson for culture, media and sport. And Quentin Letts is the Daily Mail's parliamentary sketchwriter. We shall be live at 8pm. I hope you can join us.
Thank you, Alex. Just a couple of minutes to eight. Simon King's got an eye on the weather for us.
I have indeed, Anna. Yes, good morning, everyone. We have got further wet and windy weather across the UK today. Firstly, across southern areas of England, we've got some rain moving its way northward. This is all linked into Storm Ingrid, which was named by the Portuguese Weather Service for the impacts expected there. But the centre of that low is sitting to the southwest of Cornwall at the moment, and that will bring some strong winds. So for southwest England, southeast England, up into Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, that rain is continuing to move its way northward. It will gradually ease off as it moves through North Wales, the North Midlands and Eastern England, and there'll be a few brighter spells developing for a time into this afternoon. But in southwest England, the frequent showers, the heavy rain will continue here, and there'll be some strong winds with coastal gales, large waves and coastal overtopping could bring some localised flooding. Temperatures getting to about 6 to 10 degrees. Now for northwest and northeast England, it's pretty cloudy this morning. Showers around the eastern coast. We will see further showers developing over the Pennine region, but elsewhere staying a little bit drier, temperatures of 6 to 8 Celsius. For Northern Ireland today, we've had some rain this morning. That's now clearing away to the north. There'll be a few bright spells, but the cloud will again increase this afternoon with some rain later on, temperatures of 7 or 8 degrees. And across Scotland, the heavy rain continues in some central and eastern areas of Scotland. We've seen a lot of it over the last few days. There is some flooding problems, transport disruption as well. We've got some snow over the Grampians. Driest and brightest weather will be in the northwest, and temperatures are 3 to 6 Celsius.
Simon, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 23rd of January. The headlines this morning: negotiators from Ukraine, Russia and the US are heading to Abu Dhabi for talks on ending the war in Ukraine, but territorial issues remain a major block to peace. MPs have called for the Serious Fraud Office to investigate two government home insulation schemes, which they've described as catastrophic failures. And retail sales rose last month in a better-than-expected performance over the Christmas period.
And coming up in the next hour of the programme, a BBC investigation suggests there are more than 10 huge fly-tipping sites across England containing 20,000 tonnes of waste and linked to organised crime.
At certain times, there have been half a dozen lorries or more tipping every day, bulldozers here levelling the site. So it's been quite significant in terms of the ongoing activity every day of the working week.
And ahead of tonight's Traitors final, we'll be looking at how the show has managed to perfect the art of creating TV villains. The BBC News read this morning by Jane Steele.
Diplomatic efforts to end the war in Ukraine are gathering pace, with negotiators from Kyiv set to join Russian and US officials in what President Zelensky says will be their first trilateral talks. The discussions in the United Arab Emirates over the next 2 days follow a high-level meeting in Moscow last night between President Putin and a US delegation, including President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff. Mr. Trump has said everyone is making concessions to get a deal done. From Moscow, here's our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg.
According to the Kremlin, the discussions in Moscow were substantive, constructive and very frank. But there was no agreement on the key sticking point, territory. After the meeting, President Putin's foreign policy aide Yuri Ushakov said the US envoys had been told that without resolution of the territorial issue, there could be no long-term peace in Ukraine. He gave no details, but Moscow has been demanding that Ukraine cede those parts of the Donbas region still under Kyiv's control, Ukrainian land that Russia has failed to seize in nearly 4 years of war. Mr. Ushakov said President Putin had made it clear that until a diplomatic solution could be achieved, Russia would continue to pursue the objectives of its special military operation. This, he said, was especially true on the battlefield.
Speaking after talks with Donald Trump yesterday, President Zelensky said the remaining issue to resolve was all about the land. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford has the latest from Kiev.
These first trilateral talks are a kind of crunch time. As Volodymyr Zelensky puts it, they're a chance to see whether Moscow is really serious about peace or just playing games. There is, of course, no trust for Vladimir Putin at all here. After almost 4 years of all-out war, Russian missile and drone attacks are targeting civilian energy infrastructure with renewed intensity, right in the depths of winter, trying to freeze Ukraine into submission. But the big and public sticking point in talks for now is still land, Russia's demand to be gifted areas it's failed to win through fighting. Politicians often talk about red lines, but Ukraine's line in the eastern Donbas region is drawn in soldiers' blood, and Volodymyr Zelensky is adamant he won't cross it.
The European Union has said it will defend itself against any form of coercion after President Trump withdrew his threat to levy tariffs on US allies who oppose his plan to take over Greenland. Speaking after an emergency meeting of EU leaders in Brussels last night, the European Council President Antonio Costa said the bloc would continue to stand up for its interests. The President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, told a news conference the EU had responded well to President Trump's threat.
We followed four key principles: firmness, outreach, preparedness and unity. And it was effective, so going forward we should maintain this very approach.
President Trump is at the centre of fresh criticism after he claimed NATO troops had stayed a little back off the front lines during the war in Afghanistan. Speaking to Fox News, he renewed his criticism of the alliance, saying he wasn't sure it would be there if the US needed it. More than 450 British service personnel were killed during the Afghan conflict. The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, said the president was questioning the sacrifice of British forces. The Labour chair of the Commons Foreign Affairs Committee, Dame Emily Thornberry, told BBC Question Time the remarks were outrageous.
It's an absolute insult. It's an insult to 457 families who lost someone in Afghanistan. How dare he say we weren't on the front line?
MPs on the Public Accounts Committee say thousands of people are living in homes that pose a risk to their health and safety after what they describe as the catastrophic failure of two government insulation schemes. Major defects have been found in more than 30,000 houses fitted with insulation since 2022. Zoe Conway reports.
The committee is scathing in its criticism of the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero, saying senior officials paid virtually no attention to the schemes, which began in 2022, and which it says were doomed to fail. Over the last 15 years, billions of pounds of public money have been spent on insulation to make homes warmer and help cut energy bills. But in too many cases, the work has been of such low quality, it has led to damp and mould. The committee said the level of non-compliance by installers was so high, the Serious Fraud Office should be called in. The government said it had inherited a broken system from the Conservatives and said that of all the non-compliant homes found so far, more than 50% had been remediated at no cost to the consumer.
The BBC has discovered there are more than 500 illegal dumps operating across England, with at least 11 huge sites containing more than 20,000 tonnes of waste. Police say many are linked to organised crime gangs. Residents living nearby say more needs to be done to clean them up and protect the environment. Our Rural Affairs correspondent Jenny Kumar reports.
More than 740 illegal tips were shut down last year, but there were still more than 500 others in use in December, according to Environment Agency data. Many of them are in the countryside. Some have been operating for years. Among the largest are a 280,000-tonne site in Cheshire and two 50,000-tonne sites in Lancashire and Cornwall. Campaigners say not enough has been done to stop the illegal activities and to clean up the sites, even when those responsible have been prosecuted. The Environment Agency said it was committed to tackling waste crime and trying to disrupt those who profited from it.
Official figures published this morning show UK retail sales bounced back over the Christmas period. The Office for National Statistics says the quantity of goods purchased rose by 0.4% in December after falling by 0.1% the previous month. Here's our business correspondent Emma Simpson.
After an unexpected fall in November, retail sales saw a modest rise in December. The ONS says this was helped by strong online sales, with jewellers doing particularly well thanks to a high demand for gold and silver. Food sales were also up, but non-food shops like department and clothing stores saw a decline. The ONS says over the festive quarter as a whole, sales were down compared with the previous 3 months. It's been a difficult period overall for retailers. Consumers did spend at Christmas, but it came late, prioritising food, looking for promotions and being cautious with their money.
The Australian Internet Safety Regulator, who introduced the country's social media ban for under-16s, has told the BBC she's working closely with the UK authorities. Sir Keir Starmer has announced a consultation on implementing a similar ban and is facing pressure from some MPs to act immediately. Julie Inman-Grant said the ban was going pretty well in Australia. She said it was important children were protected.
With these systems that are literally built to keep them entrenched and entranced, it's just not a fair fight. To make their platform safer and to keep kids away until they're ready is, I think, that monumental circuit breaker move. And if other countries do that, then we have a network effect.
TikTok has completed a multi-billion pound deal that establishes a separate American subsidiary of the video sharing platform in order to avoid a ban in the US. In 2024, Congress passed a law stating that the Chinese-owned app should either be sold to an American buyer or banned, citing national security concerns over its ties to the government in Beijing. Some of the biggest names in rock and pop have recorded a new album in aid of the children's charity War Child. Help 2 is the sequel to the 1995 album Help, which saw Blur and Oasis appear on the same record at the height of their Britpop rivalry. Our music correspondent Mark Savage has been listening to the new release.
Tonight is heavy. The first new music from Arctic Monkeys in 4 years is also the first release from the charity album Help 2. More than 30 artists signed up for the project, including Olivia Rodrigo, Blur and Pulp's Jarvis Cocker.
Lots of kids are growing up in war zones and that's horrible.
Organisers say proceeds will go towards helping the more than 500 million children affected by war around the world. The album will be released on the 6th of March.
Mark Savage reporting.
Jane, thank you. It is 8:10. Not for the first time in the first year of Donald Trump's second term, American allies are wiping their brows at the end of this week. There are still some aftershocks. The Trump comments about NATO allies failing to be on the front lines in Afghanistan has caused real outrage this morning. But the overall mood seems to be phew, another crisis dodged. Donald Trump seems to feel that he can now say he got what he wanted over Greenland, but without actually getting anything concrete that he didn't have before. The world is still spinning and the Atlantic relationship still exists. Is that true or false? What are the lessons we need to learn from what has just happened? Sir Alex Younger, the former head of MI6, is here in the studio. Morning to you.
Good morning.
How worried were you at the beginning of the week?
I was really worried. It was getting dangerously binary. And I think for all of the respectable technical arguments about Arctic security, there was a lot of ego in the conversation. So the existence and appearance of an off-ramp was extremely welcome.
What's your take on who arranged the off-ramp more successfully? In other words, did the Americans blink or did the Europeans just fold in a way that allows Donald Trump now to say that he say what he is saying about Greenland?
Look, I don't want to exacerbate the ego conversation by going on about who blinked first. You know, luckily there's been an outbreak of statesmanship overdue, in my view. I mean, I think if I look at Davos more broadly, though, it's interesting. America really makes the price. You can see the power of the country, the power of its economy, the personality of the president. You know, it was dominant. But it also might go down as the moment where the limits of a sort of hyper-transactional foreign policy and the use of financial coercion kind of reached its high point. Because I think, in that sense, the US president did realise that his approach to Greenland was coming at an increasingly unacceptable cost, both domestically and in terms of the European reaction.
Do you think that message has been given to him by people doing your former job in the CIA,
yeah,
by senior NATO people, American military officers among them? I mean, is there a, we don't know, do we, how much gets through to Donald Trump and in what form, but is that your suspicion?
No, I very much doubt that it was I don't think these decisions are taken in an institutional framework at all. I think it would have been his instincts.
Which is one of the extraordinary differences between him and really every American president we can remember.
I know. And when I look at him negotiating with Xi Jinping, for instance, you've got polar opposites. You know, you've got the Chinese putting weeks and months of preparations into meetings. And you have Donald Trump going with his gut, which does confer some advantages for him. But, of course, there's some issues around the consistency of it all.
What the Europeans are saying is effectively that they saw him off, particularly on questions of trade, that it became obvious to the American side and to Donald Trump himself that there would be an enormous cost if he were to press ahead with what he wanted to do, and specifically with those trade sanctions, those extra trade sanctions he was going to impose on Europe if they stuck to their position. Is that right, do you think? Does Europe have a power that it has just woken up to, that it didn't really understand properly before?
Yeah, I think there was the practical aspects and there was the vibe shift. So the practical aspects is that what you say is true. There was a rather cutting comment from Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, basically, you know, bring it on, I'm not afraid of European working groups. And certainly the US is significantly more agile and powerful than Europe. But this was so close. I mean, this was such a glaring red line. The idea that economic coercion could be used to influence self-determination just undercuts everything. And it produced, I think, a steeliness in the European reaction that probably surprised most Europeans. And that, in turn, I think, brings you to something of a vibe shift, caught where I think Carney caught the moment quite well with his speech.
Yeah. So Mark Carney, Canadian Prime Minister, of course, former boss of the Bank of England, made that speech, didn't he, where he talked about the middle powers and the changes there need to be. And changes, he said, you can't wait and talk about it. You've got to do those changes now. What do you make about the essential suggestion was that they needed to gang together, to be together in a world of superpowers?
Well, look, first of all, as your listeners will know, I have been talking a lot as well about the need for us to understand that there has been a permanent shift. This is normal. We're not going back to the way things were before. I regret it, but there's been a shift for all sorts of reasons, from a world dictated by institutional rules to a world dictated by strongmen and deals. And it's not absolute, but it's a fact. And until we internalise that, we've got a problem. And that was the first part of his sort of realism speech. The second part was the principles, though, which is that we as medium powers need to cleave to the idea that we've got a set of things in common which make us stronger collectively. I thought he put it very well. And it's a really good framework. Of course, the issue, and this gets you to the frustrations that Zelensky outed yesterday, is the gap between that philosophy and stuff actually happening. And again, I think that there has been huge progress in that space. But I hear it as a call for us to walk the walk as well as talk the talk.
But when it comes to stuff actually happening, what stuff? I mean, in practical terms, what does it mean? Does it mean, for instance, cozying up to China? In other words, being a kind of non-aligned group in the modern era who are willing to do deals with any superpower bloc and don't mind about the morality of it, or indeed the good sense long term, because they just need to?
Yeah, no, so look, that's a great question. And the answer is emphatically not. And it was, I think, a slight weak point in the speech. Is it? He explicitly rejected this, by the way. But you must not take away the idea of some moral equivalence between China and America. You know, at the end of the day, do you want to live, you know, under the U.S. government or the Chinese Communist Party? I mean, it's you must not throw out the baby with the bathwater here. And I think he was saying that. But you know, he talked about the undesirable aspects of hegemonic power and the need for us to attempt to sustain the benefits of global institutions which regulate our behaviour. And I think that central point applies as much to China as to America, and I think probably he could have emphasised that more.
What does it mean in trade terms then? Because you think of the European Union and its very strict trade policies when it comes to trading with the rest of the world and controls on that trade. Does the implication of that mean that there has to be a kind of a trading body, almost as it were, for the middle powers that is separate from the way in which we do things at the moment?
Well, certainly you could really do with a reform of the trading infrastructure. But the bottom line, and I think Mark Carney flicked at this as well, is what we've seen over the last few years, and particularly last year, was the weaponization of supply chains and trade taking on an economic security and security salience that it didn't have before. Arguably, you know, that's a new form of globalization. China weaponizing rare earths, America imposing tariffs. We're in that new world. It's another thing we need to face up to. And I think it would be profoundly naive not to recognize that. We're in a politicized trade environment. We, as Europe, including the UK, need to recognize that. We've got things that we can bring to that party, and we should.
Let's turn to Greenland itself, because one of the things you often hear about Donald Trump, or at least you used to, at least until this week, is people would say, oh, he said this, he said that, and then actually, in quieter terms, they'd say, you know, he's got a point. On Greenland, has he got a point?
I've been clear from the beginning that the melting of the ice, the alliance between Russia and China, and the increasing geopolitical competition between us, it significantly increases the salience of the Arctic in general and Greenland in particular, and that we have been slow to organise to effect to deal with that.
Have we, though?
Yes.
And if we are slow, hasn't the United States been part of that slow?
Yes, because ultimately we need to respond to this with capabilities and doctrine and a generation of deterrence, and that work needs to be done. But if I was advising Donald Trump on his Arctic policy now, and I'm not.
Well, you kind of are, but yes, I take your point.
I mean, I would say to him that he's got a point about this, but that if he really wants to contribute to Arctic security, the first thing he needs to do is stop doing what he's doing, right? Because the attempt to annex Greenland is profoundly destabilizing, and Greenland can't be seen in isolation. A good example of that is another island called Svalbard, which lies halfway between Norway and the North Pole. By treaty, it's part of Norway, but it has a Russian population. It's a really febrile environment. Lots of the sort of academic wargaming about how the Third World War starts is all about the Russians grabbing Svalbard and stuff. So if you start a land grab in the Arctic as the ice melts, you're off to the races. That's just one example. There are others of the need to approach this through a collective security lens through NATO, accepting that NATO needs to do more and get away from this zero-sum stuff.
So has this been the jolt, then, that could make that happen?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've heard nothing. I mean, who was talking about Arctic security, you know, a month ago? So this is Trump does put things on the agenda. You can't shy away from that fact. Equally, I think it's quite important when you look at Europe's track record here. You know, we ran down our military industrial capabilities egregiously. And we are building back, and the contrast with 2022 is really marked. We've got a long way to go, though, and the Arctic is now a real focus of that.
Can we, though? Because one of the concerns about Europe is that, and it's not just a sort of political attack, oh, it's all talk and Europeans never do anything, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the concerns, particularly about the EU, is that it just is not set up in a way that can allow concerted action. And you look at the various disagreements there are between the various partners, some of them more, for instance, pally towards Vladimir Putin than others, et cetera, et cetera. Actually, the idea that Europe is woken up by this suggests that there is a thing called Europe, including the UK, which just doesn't exist.
Yeah, I'd say two things about that. One, the invasion of Ukraine was a huge intelligence failure on the Russians' part. They didn't expect the level of resistance that they were going to meet. And they absolutely did not expect Europe to get its act together to the extent that it has. This was a war that was supposed to be over in 2 weeks. And there's a massive downside surprise for Vladimir Putin. So can we just please bank the fact that, certainly to my mind, because I share a lot of your cynicism, I think the result has been at the top end of expectations. Secondly, in terms of Europe's ability to get its act together and deal with these security threats, it can do that. You know, it's got the resources, it's got the population, it's got the capabilities. It's, as you say, about concerting them to effect. If I was to put it all into one word, though, I would say that the biggest problem is our relationship with innovation. And innovation delivers economic prosperity and it delivers military security. And that is the key. And it's something Xi Jinping understands really well. I think Donald Trump understands it really well. If there's one thing I would like for Christmas, it's, you know, 10 global scale technology companies in Europe. I think you would be amazed how that would transform our position, our ability to help Ukraine right now, our ability to grow our economies. It's, you know, it's at the core of this.
Sir Alex Younger, as ever, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just coming round to 23 minutes past eight, the biggest programme on TV at the moment has its finale tonight. The Traitors has been steadily gaining in popularity. It's now picking up more than 8 million viewers. And they've been drawn in by some pretty treacherous behaviour on the show. So how do you create a memorable villain like these ones?
I am now, and I have been all through the game completely faithful. To the Traitors!
I want to ask you, Nick, how can you do that? You've passed paper around, people around this table with my name on.
Craig, you've made a number of wild accusations over the last couple of weeks.
We've all been told we can't discuss nominations, and you told me who you were voting for this week.
No, I didn't.
Can we have the flowers in really bright yellow?
You've just made it look worse.
Can we try black and white? The other one just looks like funeral.
You're giving me a headache. I've got a headache because you.
So what is it? By the way, it, just in case they didn't spring immediately to mind, you heard Louisa Zisman there from The Apprentice at the end, Nasty Nick Bateman from the very first series of Big Brother, and then, of course, Jonathan Ross in The Celebrity Traitors kicked off that little montage for you. So what is it about the Traitors format in particular that's proving such a huge rating success for the BBC? Is it all about having really top quality villains in the mix as part of the show? Well, Reverend Lisa Coupland was in season three of The Traitors, and Nick Johns is a reality TV producer who's worked on hit shows like I'm a Celebrity and Love Island. Good morning, both.
Good morning, Anna. How are you?
I'm well. What are you thinking, Lisa, when you watch this? I mean, apart from, I bet, wishing that you were just back on it again and back in the middle of everything. What do you think of the, yeah, I bet, of the characters and the narrative, the way it's all played out this time round?
Honestly, I think the Traitors this season have been brilliant. I mean, Rachel and Stephen have really come across with the goods, haven't they? And I think as viewers, we love a clever villain. I mean, we really want to get invested. And, you know, in the Traitors, they get to play a sort of manipulate and play a game of four-dimensional chess with the other people in the castle. And I think watching someone who pulls off a risky bluff or steers a group subtly without getting caught scratches that same itch as a good heist movie, you know, a good heist film like The Italian Job, where we all love Michael Caine's character, Charlie Croker. And I think it's not that viewers love lying. They love skill. And I think that's what the Traitors bring to the game. They have that skill to make bold decisions and control and shape the narrative of the game. And I think audiences naturally gravitate towards the people driving the story rather than those being dragged along by it.
And because you've seen it, Lisa, behind the scenes, what is it like when you eventually watch those episodes? Do they match what you perceived as happening around you at the time, or is so much of it in the way that these people and their villainy has been edited?
No, not at all. I mean, what you see on the TV is what you get. You know, there's no direction, there's no steering the group in any way from the production teams or anything. It all happens organically. So obviously they can't show everything that's being filmed. I mean, otherwise we'd be sat in front of the TV for an awfully long time. But it is put together in a way that is what happens, and that's how it's happening. So they do a really good job there, and I think it is the characters within the programme, that, you know, the cast, and all credit to the researchers and the production team who put these casts together. They do a phenomenal job with that.
Yeah, and Nick, I mean, that is a crucial part of it, isn't it? It's picking the right people to be in it, and particularly when it comes to the villains. As Lisa was saying there, you need to pick clever villains. You know, the audience, they don't just want out-and-out nastiness. They want a bit of intelligence with it.
You need to pick clever villains. And I think, just to talk about the traitor specifically, what is so fantastic there is that it's a format that just encourages people to play the game very hard, whether that's as a traitor or as a faithful. And I have to say, Rachel, this series, and with Stephen in her slipstream, she's just been the most awesome player. She's been cool, she's been calm, she's been callous. And what she's got there is she's got a very clear role to play within the format. Is she a villain? I think it's an interesting question. I think there's certainly been some moral complexity about her choices, but in choosing her, they've chosen someone who's made such a fantastic contribution to how the game has played through.
And as someone, Nick, who's been involved, as we said, in some of those shows where a villain is part of making, it's one of the things that draws people in, how difficult is it to actually identify those individuals in the casting stage? Because you can't know how they'll respond and how they'll act when it comes to the real thing.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And you're right in saying that you can't. But actually what you can do when you are casting characters is explore the contribution that you feel that they're going to make to the show. I think it's absolutely the case that reality is all about storytelling. And as a reality producer, what you are looking to do is you're looking to find people that can fulfill roles within a story. And heroes are boring without villains, aren't they? I mean, there's no Little Mermaid without Ursula. There's no Dorothy without the Wicked Witch of the West. We're looking for those characters that can really challenge, provoke and prod and actually really help shape the narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that it feels like the people we might perceive as the villains in the story are the ones that as viewers really sustain our interest the most.
Yeah, that is true. And that contrast is so important, as you were saying as well, isn't it? Nick Johns, reality TV producer, and the Reverend Lisa Copeland from Series 3 of The Traitors. Thank you both.
It is 8:30, sport time, here's Mike.
Justin, thank you. Cameron Norrie has played 6, lost 6 against the German Alexander Zverev in his career so far. Something has to change today if we are to maintain British interest in the singles at the Australian Open. Norrie is the last Brit standing in Melbourne, and he's finally on court and underway against the German Zverev in the third round. So, will it be lucky number 7 today? Abigail Johnson watching live in Melbourne.
Yeah, and the very good signs are early on for Norrie, who's already pumping his fist and cheering because he's held his opening service game and he is love 40 on the Alexander Zverev serve. Now, the number 3 seed made the final last year, but his form has been a bit questionable of late. He's dropped a set in his opening 2 rounds, and Norrie does have the encouragement of a first round triumph at Roland Garros over Daniil Medvedev last year. He was 4-0 down on that particular head-to-head, and he's lunging for the kill here. Forehand inside in winner on John Cain Arena. That is saluted by the Norrie box, and the number 26 seed has the early break on the third show court. That's 2 love in the favour of Cam Norrie.
Strong start from the British number 1. They played a 5-set thriller, didn't they, the last time Norrie and Zverev met at the Australian Open. You can hear coverage of that match right now on BBC Sounds. Earlier today in Melbourne, Annabelle, another routine win for Carlos Alcaraz, the world number 1, of course, looking to win the career Grand Slam out in Australia. He eased through to the fourth round, didn't he?
Yeah, as expected, really. It was a first time meeting with Francis Corentin Moutet, and he's a very skilled player, the lefty, but Alcaraz has all the skill and all the status and all the form as well. So 6-2, 6-4, 6-1 in just 2 hours and 5 minutes on Rod Laver Arena. That was no surprise. The Spaniard sailing back into round four at the Australian Open.
Yes, his 100th match at a Grand Slam, Alcaraz, an incredible record. 87 wins, just 13 losses. Finally, Abigail, spectator conduct is back in the headlines at the Australian Open. Some strong words earlier this morning from the Kazakh player, Yulia Putintseva, who was booed and heckled throughout her victory over the Turkish qualifier Zeynep Sonmez. Here's a flavour of her post-match on-court interview to give you a flavour of the atmosphere, followed by Putintseva's thoughts in the press conference.
Yulia, you are through to the fourth round of the Australian Open for the first time.
I'm in right now. I don't want to even think about it. I'm here. I'm enjoying my moment and I'm very happy with that.
Today, I think, was really a lot of disrespectful moments when they were screaming between my first and second serve, like just to make me mistake. And I was like, okay, now I'm not going to lose. I'm very happy that I kept my calm because Yulia last year would probably throw something at them at some moment.
Abigail, the Australian Open is known for its rowdy crowds at times, but did it go too far earlier?
I was there just for the end of the match, and they were very loud, the fans in the favour of Zeynep Sonmez. There was a lot of red colour across the stands, so they were very much there in force. I think if Putintseva feels that they did, there is something to that. She also had a bit of a sassy reaction to her first round triumph over Beatriz Haddad-Maia from Brazil, and the Brazilian fans can get very atmospheric, but that was a lot more restrained, I would say, than her probably minute-long reaction with hands to her ears and dancing at the side of the court to getting the win today. She is a player who wears her heart on her sleeve, the Kazakh. She didn't make it personal on any level, and I think the way that she responded did suggest that it had added a bit of needle to the match. It had threatened her focus, and she was able to really hang in there and dial in on the task at hand to ultimately come through that in three sets.
All right, Abigail Johnson live in Melbourne watching Cameron Norrie, who, as we heard, is an early breakup in his match with Alexander Zverev. You can watch that, or follow it at least, rather, on the BBC Sport website and on BBC Sounds.
Thank you, Mike. It is 26 minutes to 9 at 9 o'clock here on Radio 4. It's Lauren Laverne.
My castaway this week is the actor Adil Akhtar, who still remembers the thrill of his first performance when he was at school.
A bunch of us decided to put on a play called The Homecoming by Harold Pinter. Then all these teachers came and sit down, watch our sort of ramshackle little play that we were putting on. They laughed at different points and took me serious at different points. And I remember that being like a moment.
Adil Akhtar, My Castaway. Do join us to hear his Desert Island Discs this morning at 9.
The weather, on and on it goes. Cloudy overall, spells of rain, bit of snow, hill snow at least, in northeastern Scotland.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
Talks on ending the war in Ukraine will take place in the United Arab Emirates later between delegations from Kiev, Moscow and Washington. An agreement on territory in the eastern Donbass region remains the key sticking point in negotiations. The European Union has said it will defend itself against any form of coercion after President Trump withdrew his threat to levy tariffs on US allies who oppose his plan to take over Greenland. Speaking after an emergency meeting of EU leaders in Brussels last night, the European Council President Antonio Costa said the bloc would continue to stand up for its interests. The BBC has discovered there are more than 500 illegal rubbish dumps operating across England. Police say many of the sites are run by criminal gangs. MPs have warned that thousands of people are living in damp and mouldy homes after what they describe as the catastrophic failure of two government insulation schemes. The Public Accounts Committee has said the Serious Fraud Office should investigate. Official figures show UK retail sales bounced back last month in a better-than-expected performance over Christmas. The Office for National Statistics said the quantity of goods bought was estimated to have risen by 0.4% in December.
Thank you, Jane. It's 24 minutes to nine now. 6 weeks after Australia banned social media for under-16s, the world is watching really closely to try to gauge its early success. Here, a consultation has been announced about whether we should try the same thing. It is still early days, so difficult to gauge with much certainty. But our Australia correspondent Katie Watson has been speaking to the country's e-safety commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant, who's told her that she's working closely with UK regulators. And Katie's on the line. So, Katie, tell us, what did you learn from that conversation with the e-safety commissioner?
I think the takeaway is just this mammoth task in making sure that under-16s stay off platforms, not just come off platforms, but stay off platforms. That's something that she said is very important. And obviously she says she's talking to the UK, she's talking to Ofcom on a monthly basis. So clearly there's a lot of connection between the two countries as the UK looks to implement a ban of its own. But, you know, I think I was just in the street and three under-16s came up to me and said, it's not working. We're all on it. We haven't been kicked off it. And that also speaks to this, you know, this huge challenge, not just of tech companies, but also of opposing the ban, but also of young people still staying on it. Now, the eSafety Commission says 4.7 million accounts were closed in the first half of December. So they're big numbers. It doesn't say who exactly is going on to other accounts and platforms that aren't part of the legislation. But I asked her whether that big number proves that something is working.
Well, initially, yes. So like I said, that was sort of the easy part. To keep that number in perspective, there are about 2.5 million young Australians between the ages of 8 and 15. And when you think about it, it's taken us about 20 years to get here. So if you think about Facebook was established in 2004 and Twitter, now X, 2006, these were online spaces that weren't built for safety and they weren't built for kids. They were built for adults. But eventually kids from all over the world have gravitated and inhabited these spaces. And in many cases, none of these platforms ever enforce their own policies around 13 and under, or just use self-declaration or age gating. So in some ways, what we're asking them to do is retrofit a set of tools by identifying who is under 16 and who isn't without doing it in a way that's too invasive for adults.
And Katie, you asked her about the impact that the changes were having on Australia, on the country, but not everybody agreed with this. There were differing views. And you also wanted to know about the impact that being the person to bring in the changes has had on her.
That's right. I mean, it's not the first kind of controversial act, if you like, that she's been involved with. Elon Musk has previously called her a censorship commissar, an unelected bureaucrat, people who don't believe in the ban have obviously been very, you know, forthcoming in their disapproval of what she's doing. The whole point of this ban is to talk about online harm. And she told me about the personal impact that it's also had on her.
Well, unfortunately, I've been living that reality for the past several years. I get regular death threats. Of course, a lot of these companies have deep pockets. They lawyer up, which is their democratic right. But it's a form of threat to get us to back down. So again, I think you have to have resolve in the face of this strength, and you have to have a certain degree of resilience. The overriding goal is making sure that all Australians, particularly children, have safer, more positive experiences online. Like I said, the people with the most to lose here, if this is successful, are the companies themselves.
That is Australia's e-safety commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant, speaking to our correspondent, Katie Watson.
And that brings us to exactly 20 to 9. Now, the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has said she's going to defend very vigorously any legal challenges to moving asylum seekers into sites like a former military camp in East Sussex. She says while she understands local opposition to the Crowborough site, closing asylum hotels where thousands of migrants, of course, are currently housed, is one of her top priorities.
What I would say to local people is, I do understand where you're coming from, but we do need to close asylum hotels, which are also causing community concern. We need a longer term solution for how we house migrants. But I also know that if you get people out of hotels, that will have a deterrent effect on the people that are trying to get into our country. So I will work with communities as much as possible. I get where they're coming from, but closing asylum hotels is one of my top priorities. And if there are legal challenges, I will be facing them in court and we will defend them vigorously.
Well, let us talk now to Lazar Aghani, the Conservative MP for Sussex Weald, which includes Crowborough, where the camp is going to be held and which we understand is about to open. Aghani, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Why is it wrong for Crowborough to be used in this way?
Well, you mentioned at the top of your report former army barracks or army camps. It's not a former anything. It's a functioning training camp. This Crowborough training camp is the largest training camp in the southeast. Last year, it had 6,000 young army and RAF cadets training there. They've all been kicked off. It's also a site that's used for training for the police and the fire services. So it's not a former anything. It's a functioning training camp.
Just on that point, where have they gone? Where is being used now?
Well, last week I had a meeting with my cadet and RAF young people and their families. They were kicked out just before Christmas and we were able to find spaces for the army cadets. We are still trying to make sure that they're comfortable with the options being provided for the Air Force cadets. That still hasn't finished yet and there's no confidence that they'll have those alternative sites for a period of time, which is also a massive concern. And this is the big challenge. This is a small town. There's this functioning training camp is in a forest on the edge of a town. And there's been no consultation with the community. And it's all happened, you know, overnight, which is causing a huge amount of anxiety. Furthermore, what's unique about Crowborough, the training camp, it was previously looked at by the Home Office a few years ago and they found they couldn't sign it off as safe, legal and compliant. So we've been asking the Home Office repeatedly, you know, how is the site going to be safe, legal and compliant? And if it is, please show us the assessment. And none of that has been forthcoming. So we are incredibly anxious. And as I said, you know, 6,000 kids trained there last year. This is not a form or anything. It was a functioning training camp.
But what is it that you think could go wrong if the asylum seekers are there? And we're talking about, quite a few people eventually, particularly men, 500 or so men. What do you think the threat, if you're putting it like that, to the community is?
Well, I think, you know, when you've got undocumented men, potentially 500, they'll be transitioning through or staying there. We do not know how long the camp will be open for. There's not much to do in the town. There's not a huge amount of spaces to go off and do activities. There's not a huge amount of social spaces. We don't have an abundance of public services. Getting hold of a GP appointment right now is quite difficult for an average person that lives in Crowborough. You know, people will potentially be bored. And also, you know, we know that when these places are stood up, normally they're stood up somewhere that's quite, you know, away from communities that are already living there. It can attract the wrong sort of people coming in, trying to pick them up to work on the black market as well. We don't know what the outcome is going to be, but the reality is there's been no consultation with the town, that we do not know how they're going to be supported and what public services they will get. We've been not consulted. We have no idea that the people that function there at the moment who've been kicked off, where they can go to in the future.
Well, what do you make of the Home Secretary's point, the wider point that we just heard her make? There needs to be something to stop people coming across the Channel in small boats. This sort of policy has that deterrent effect, she says. We have to do it.
As soon as I heard about this last October, I held the first community public meeting in Crowborough. I asked the Home Office, is it going to be any cheaper housing asylum seekers at Crowborough than at hotels? The level of investment they will have to make and the resources they'll have to put in, the Home Office officials confirmed that it is no cheaper housing the asylum seekers in Crowborough than it is in a hotel.
No, so but it's sure. The fact that it's not a hotel, isn't it? Isn't that the point the Home Secretary was making? At the moment, people think they're coming here and being put up in hotels. If they're in a camp, it sounds and feels different.
Well, the site has been adapted. The pictures are on social media. I'm not sure how that is a deterrent. We also asked the Home Office if when people, the asylum seekers, arrive on the camp, will they be in any way detained to limit their movement? That's not the case either. They can come and go as they please. So I'm not sure what data the Home Office can show us to then evidence that this is in any way a deterrent. We as a local community are incredibly anxious that the impact is going to have not only on our services, but also the people that have been made to leave the camp and when they can potentially go back
and
continue with their training.
Well, yeah, Nezra Ghani, Conservative MP for Sussex Weald. Thank you very much.
It's 14 minutes to nine. A BBC investigation has discovered there are currently more than 500 illegal waste dumps operating across England. At least 11 of them are huge sites that contain more than 20,000 tonnes of waste. The police say many of them are linked to organised crime gangs, and people who live near to them say that more needs to be done to clean them up and protect the environment, as Jenny Kumar reports.
At an illegal waste site near Gloucester, tons of construction waste slopes down to a watercourse. It's massive, covering 2 acres.
It's damaged a lot of vegetation, trees.
Charlie Coates is chairman of Hynham Parish Council.
At certain times, there have been half a dozen lorries or more tipping every day, bulldozers here levelling the site. So it's been quite significant in terms of the ongoing activity every day of the working week.
What kind of impact would you say this is having?
This is a public highway here, and that's caused road safety concerns. There's been noise, there's been smell, there's been smoke.
The Environment Agency says it's investigating, but locals feel furious and frustrated at the lack of change. We contacted the person believed to be using the site, but he declined to comment.
The BBC has learned there are more than 500 illegal waste sites operating across England, and at least 11 are massive, containing more than 20,000 tonnes of waste. For criminals, this is big business.
Police!
Police!
There you are!
West Mercia police say this type of crime is on the rise. Earlier this month, officers carried out a raid as part of an investigation into money laundering linked to illegal waste dumping.
I'm going to have to arrest you.
Two men were arrested and £100,000 in cash was seized.
Don't have to say anything, but it may harm your defence.
The police say tackling these gangs is complex and takes time, but they've had some success in closing down sites in the past, including one in Worcestershire.
So there's an awful lot of money in waste processing. And
Inspector Dave Wise is from West Mercia Police.
It's organised crime because it requires that organisation. It is operated as a business, but just without the people behind it paying the appropriate levies and taxes and operating within the licences. It's not always, but it can be, that cliche idea of organised crime where there's violence and intimidation and threats involved. But what we're talking here is that illegitimate business operation that is individuals profiting from pollution of the environment.
Plasterboard, bricks, rubble, daily household waste.
But some residents living near another illegal waste site in Worcestershire tell me they have felt threatened.
Why is it that you wanted to do this interview anonymously?
Primarily because of the fear of being intimidated. The fact that these sites are so big and there are so many, it just goes to show that the criminals know that the authorities are inadequate, that the penalties are inadequate.
The landowner of the site in Worcestershire didn't want to speak to us when we visited, but has previously said the land is rented out. The tenants and operators of the other illegal sites targeted by West Mercia police have failed to respond to the BBC. But here in Kidlington in Oxfordshire, action is being taken.
The scale of the site is really quite astounding. It runs from around 500 feet along the A34 and the rubbish is piled up to around 20 feet high. But what's really quite striking is the strong, acrid smell.
The Environment Agency says it's made the exceptional decision to clear the site because of its fire risk.
This tip has been
but there's anger at how the agency has dealt with this. This is Erica Popplewell from the campaign group River Action.
This isn't something that was dumped overnight. There will have been people coming and dumping illegally for months and months and months, and the Environment Agency were made aware. So they are taking action now and have agreed that they will clean up the site. But the price tag for that is £10 million. It would have been better if the dump had been stopped happening earlier so that the cost of clear-up was a lot less, and of course the environmental damage wouldn't have happened.
The Environment Agency says it's committed to tackling waste crime and it's pulling every lever to disrupt those who profit from the harm they cause. Emma Viner is their enforcement and investigations manager.
We share the public's disgust and we are taking action. Every year we're shutting down hundreds of illegal waste sites, preventing waste from being illegally exported. But it's a dynamic picture. For all the waste sites that we're closing, we're seeing more and more pop up around the country.
But for communities living near these illegal dumps, there's a feeling that the authorities have a huge mountain to climb to stop this crime.
As Jenny Kumar reporting, now 29 English councils have postponed the elections they were supposed to be having in May while the shake-up of two-tier local government's happening in some areas. The argument for that is that it's a waste of time and costly as well, electing people who won't be doing those jobs for long. The argument against is that people in those areas won't get to make their democratic voice heard at a moment when they should be doing exactly that. Well, Professor Tony Travis joins us from LSE's Department of Government, Associate Dean of the School of Public Policy. Good morning.
Morning.
How unusual is it to see elections on this sort of scale cancelled with just a couple of months to go?
Oh.
Ah, Professor Tony Travis. It sounds like you can't hear.
Hold on a second. Yeah, we're going
to... Sounds like you can't hear me, yeah.
He's here in the studio.
Hmm. Try and sort some headphones out for Professor Tony Travis.
So Tony is here in the studio in London, and we have now, by the miracle of modern science, provided headphones that work for him.
Excellent.
You'll have to ask the question again. I don't think he heard you, but he is definitely... I can confirm that he's here.
Good morning.
Tony. Good morning. Good, right. I'm glad you can hear me now. The question was, how unusual is it to see a number of elections on this scale cancelled with just a couple of months to go?
It's most unusual to see anything at this scale. We've had elections postponed and cancelled in the past when a council's been abolished or about to be reorganised. But what's different about this is not only the number that are being effectively cancelled, they're not going to take place, but secondly, that the government's offered councils the option of volunteering not to hold the election. So those two things are really pretty odd.
Mm. And there's going to be seemingly a legal challenge. Reform says it's going to take the government to court over this. Can you force councils to hold elections?
Well, the legislation obviously would normally have these elections taking place this year. And of course, it's the government that has encouraged councils to come forward to say they'd like to delay them and then is going to allow them to do that. So a court case, which will happen in February. It's going to be very, very late, close to the time when the elections take place in May. So it really will depend on what the court says as to whether or not the government is required to allow the elections to go ahead.
Mm. I mean, obviously, a lot of people are looking at this and saying voting is one of the most fundamental things that we get to do, and to take that away from people is a bad thing. Is that the case when we look at the arguments for and against here?
Well, I think clearly there are, at the very basis of our democracy is the idea of voting regularly in local elections, Scottish and Welsh and Northern Ireland elections, and of course for national general elections. So any disturbance in holding elections, as I say, this has happened before, though not at this scale. So I think at the particular moment when there are so many criticisms, concerns about the health of liberal democracy, signals that are sent out of this kind probably are not helpful. And it's worth remembering the Electoral Commission has been pretty critical of this delay or in cancellations in some cases.
Mm. Professor Tony Travis from the London School of Economics, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And that brings us to 6 minutes to nine. Can novelists retire? Should they retire? Julian Barnes says his latest novel is to be his last. He's 80 years old. Geoffrey Archer stopping too. That might be the only thing, I suppose, that those two authors have in common. But we have two authors on the line who have a lot in common, indeed know each other. Joanne Harris. Books include, of course, Chocolat, which was later made into a film. Her latest novel is called Vianne. And Kate Moss as well, novelist, non-fiction writer too. So the Joubert Family Chronicles, the Languedoc Trilogy, etc., etc. Kate Moss and Joanne Harris, good morning to you both.
Morning. Hello, Joanne.
Hi.
Let's start with the fact of retirement. Does it even enter... You're both much younger than the age that Julian Barnes is, but does it enter even your thinking, your subliminal thoughts, perhaps, Joanne Harris?
I don't think it does. I think when you're an author, you're in charge of the time that you spend writing. You don't really have weekends, you don't really have holidays or retirement unless you impose it on yourself. And I think there are two kinds of writer. One who hates writing but likes having written, in which case I can completely visualize a moment when they would retire. And people like me, where it's just a compulsion and I don't see that going away.
Kate Moss?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just, if you've got a story you want to tell, it's that amazing feeling when you have the prickling on the back of your neck and you think, oh my God, this is the story that I want to write down. And you become obsessed with it. And the idea that you wouldn't do that. But the thing is, Geoffrey is 85. Julian is 80. Who knows what any of us would feel? And as I understand it, what Geoffrey Archer has said is that he's writing a huge book. And Joanne knows what that's like. I'm writing a huge Norman novel now. And he says he can't imagine there being anything as big again. Hmm. And therefore, he probably wouldn't write again. And I do understand that, the idea that you're doing this big piece of work.
It might there not also be a fear, Joanne, that you're going to write something that isn't as good as what you've done before and in a sense damage your legacy or just do something that you're not happy with?
I think that's always the fear with a writer. I think a writer lives with the fear of not being as good as the last book, not getting across their message to the audience. I think we have to work through it. I've always felt it. I feel it with every single book that I write. Is this going to work? Are people going to get it? Am I ever going to get another idea again? And I completely understand that people might want to draw a line. But of course, history is full of writers who have drawn that line and have gone back to that itch of writing.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? Didn't Agatha Christie make some sort of effort to make sure that something happened to her, we'd all be okay anyway?
Yes, that's exactly right. Because I think partly what this thing about announcing retirement is being in control of your own narrative, saying, this is it. Readers, don't expect anything from me. Not having that awful moment of people saying, God, whatever happened to Geoffrey Archer? You know, this sort of thing. Agatha Christie was quite quite determined that she wouldn't let her readers down with Marple and Poirot. So during the Blitz, she wrote a final Poirot novel, Curtain, and a final Miss Marple novel, Sleeping Murder, just in case she didn't make it through the war. So she didn't leave her readers hanging. Though Poirot was published in 1975, before she died. The Miss Marple was published in the autumn of 1976, several months after she had died. And of course, it is therefore out of sequence because it's a much younger Miss Marple that we meet in Sleeping Murder. But I think it's the same thing. The idea that you are in control of the story about your writing career by saying, okay, I'm putting a stop on it. And as Joanne says, none of us wants to let our readers down, either by just fading away or by writing books that are not as good. So it is about control in a funny sort of way. And I'm sure that's partly why both Julian and Geoffrey have announced this rather than just doing it.
Might it also be slightly the publishing industry and the kind of fetishization of the young Joanne Harris that feeds into this?
I think that exists, certainly. And I don't know what it's like to be right at the end of a career, but Richard Bach, who was an author I loved as a child, said in one of his books, you know, there's a test to find out if your mission on Earth is finished. If you're still alive, it's not. And I don't know if he was talking about writing at that time, but that's the way I feel.
Yeah. And both of you are intending then, Joanne and Kate, to carry on forever.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We will die at our desks, Justin.